This podcast is sponsored by Hover, the best way to buy and manage domain names. Please visit hover.com and use promo code CHILDREN to get 10% off your first order.
He has to pay the iron price.
He has to pay the iron price.
I'll never respect you while he lives, Simpson.
Watch it all come around as I lay on the ground. Joffrey, Cersei, Illyn Payne, the Hound. They all think I'm lost, but I know where I'm found. I'm the blood in the north when it all comes down. My word is my bond, and my bond is my word. Valar to Harris, all men must serve. See as the raven flies, and time slips by. Valar, my rulers, all men must die.
Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast brought to you by baldmove.com. We're the officially unofficial podcast for HBO's Game of Thrones television series. Tonight, we're covering the finale of season four, the 10th episode, titled The Children. I'm your host, Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
You know, every time I think I'm really bringing it with the intro, and then I listen to it, and I sound like a sleepy old man on NPR. So this time, I just fucking went for it.
I was going to comment on that, actually. You're blossoming into this podcast leader role. I like it. I've been doing it for years. It's good to see somebody else forced to do it.
Because I always think, it's like, surely that was enough. Surely I brought,
so, yeah.
I brought the up-tempo. Hmm. But no, I was just listening to last week's podcast. I'm like, who is this doddering old fuck? That is trying to rock this microphone. So, reactions all over the map on this episode. I knew there was going to be a lot of book fan uproar. I was surprised at the sound and the fury of it all.
That's interesting. Is it actually that people are in an uproar, or just the book readers are in an uproar?
It seems like it's the sharpest divide of, you know, because it's mostly uproar over what is missing or what has been changed. And if you're a show watcher, you don't know.
Sure, I have no idea what's going on.
So my question to you is, as a show watcher only, what was your opinion of this episode?
I really like this episode.
Where do you see it fitting in the Game of Thrones canon as far as other finales?
Oh, well, I think it's probably the best finale
that
Game of Thrones has ever had.
Which might be damning with faint praise, because the finales have never been the oh my god episodes of Game of Thrones.
Yeah, they're like episode 9, episode 8.
Right.
Those are the big ones. So yeah, I thought this was a really, really strong season finale for them. I don't have the problem of having read the books and knowing what was taken out and what they left on the cutting room floor. So to me, none of that matters, and I just see it as a really solid episode.
Yeah, I mean, I tend to agree, and I don't, because I watched it again, and I'm like, well, maybe I'll, you know, I won't be as swept up in the excitement and some of the awesome action scenes, because I thought that some of the best fight work yet, some of the best CGI work yet, I think this was the most, it turned out that this was the most expensive episode that they've ever made. I know that last week's episode kind of ran a close second, and the Double D's in the weeks leading up to this said that they felt like this was their finest hour yet. So I don't know, maybe they just set things, the expectations to be sky high. Unfortunately, there's a lot of things that I can only talk with book readers about that we'll do in the spoiler section, and you won't be a part of, Jim.
Yeah.
So, but no, I quite liked it. I think it's easily the best finale. Again, there's not a huge amount of competition, because mostly the exclamation points have been this 9th episode. This season it was the 8th episode.
Yeah.
But I kind of feel like this episode hung right there, you know, with some of the best. It's in my top 5 probably.
Yeah, this was a really good episode. And we'll talk more about why when we get into the actual recap.
Right. And let's I was going to ask you about where you think season 4 fits in among the other seasons as far as best, but I think that's a topic best left for next week.
Okay.
Because we're not done with our Game of Thrones coverage. No, we traditionally have a season recap podcast where we talk, I'm going to talk, it's kind of, some people consider it light spoilers. I do not, because it's never came back to bite me to where I've said something with background detail or how things have changed and it ends up ruining something. You know, I mean, just think about it. Or if they've already passed something chronologically, what's the odds that they're actually going to then reuse that material in the future? It's probably not going to happen. But it's kind of interesting to talk about how things went down in the books versus how things went down in the series. It's going to be really challenging this week or this season, because there's so many deviations and there's so much new information brought in. But it's always a good time and a good way to reflect back, get a lot of your feedback out of the way. Jim and I will talk about our overall impressions. That's coming up next Tuesday. But now, enough bullshit. Let's recap this children stuff.
Okay.
John walks out into the twisted hellscape that is the Wall's Gate.
Mm-hmm.
Into the haunted forest, and he surrenders to Mance Rayder. What do you think?
Okay. So it was really cool to see the destruction outside and just let him kind of have a quiet moment walking through that. That was pretty neat. Going out to Mance Rayder, he went directly to Mance Rayder. Like, mm-hmm. There's 100,000 dudes out there. You happen to walk right to Mance Rayder?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Whatever. I'll buy it.
I mean, he's been in the Wildling camp before, so I didn't have that much of a problem.
I just think they're saying, you know, he could wander around this 100,000 man army for a while, but why waste your time?
So you find that a little implausible. What else?
Yeah, it doesn't really matter ultimately, though. we see, I don't know if it's here or before this, where Mance says who the giant was who died. Says he was the king of the giants, apparently, right?
Something like that.
Mag? I don't know his full name. They refer to him as Mag a couple times.
Yeah, the giant names are crazy.
Okay, oh, great.
They're like multi-part Magmar, Wugwam, Bugla.
No, I'm glad they're scarce then.
Yeah, so they usually have nicknames.
Okay. He was the king, apparently, right?
Yeah, well, a very old bloodline.
Yeah. So now he's dead. They're kind of pissed about that.
I thought that was interesting that, because the Wildlings are all about protesting that they are not kneelers and they don't give a shit about who's your father and who's your son. But really, they're a lot more like the Southrons than they care to admit if bloodlines and ancient heritages and names mean that much to them.
Yeah, I mean, you could say that maybe it means that much to the giants, and they know that, and so they're kind of concerned about it as far as they go, but who cares when it comes to the Wildlings?
I guess. I just thought it was John hoisting them on their own petard.
That also could be, yeah.
I've been kind of lukewarm on, I think this guy's name's Kieran Hines.
Who?
I have no idea. The guy that plays Mance Rayder.
Oh, okay.
I've been kind of lukewarm in his performances thus far, not that there's been a lot of it. I think part of it is because there was some casting news that, there was going to be a lot. The guy who played Aragorn, whose name's escaped me in The Lord of the Rings, Viggo Mortensen.
Oh, yeah.
That there was talks that maybe he would be, and, people were kind of excited about that. And then we get this guy, this kind of old, doughy looking dude. I feel like, I don't know whether it was just the greasy, stringy haircut or whether he just had better material to work with, or maybe Kit Harington has grown as an actor in the last 2 years so you can actually stand against him and have him rise to the challenge. But I liked him as this king beyond the wall a lot more.
Okay.
Are you feeling me on that, or is it just kind of same-o, or what?
It's weird because when I was watching this episode, I was thinking, do I respect this character, like this guy playing this character, can I really put myself in the scenario with him playing it? And I feel like he has gotten better. Like, yeah. I was actually thinking that during the episode, and I don't know why, because we've seen him before.
Do you think this, let's get to the end of the scene, and let's get through Stannis first before I ask that question.
Okay.
I do think that. Why do you think that if he was honest in this whole attention, hey, we're not here to conquer, we just want to hide behind your wall, why wouldn't he have shared that with John? Why wouldn't they have tried to get in contact with the Black Brothers and try to negotiate peace before they just started, you know, killing everybody at Castle Black and attacking? I mean, they didn't even try.
Yeah, I mean, is this 100,000 man thing an army, or is it a caravan of courage? Like, what is this thing?
See, I think that's what...
It seems like an army to me.
But I think that's actually something that we found out this week, that 100,000 does, you know, that's not just troops, that's men, women, and children.
Sure.
And they can't all just climb the wall. They need the gate because you can't take your elderly and your...
Yeah,
and
your babies are not going to climb over that wall.
You're not going to sling them over the wall and not with the side going anyway. But he wants to offer... I mean, John's offer is ridiculous. Turn your army and go home. And his offer is decidedly less ridiculous. Open the gate and I promise the bloodshed will be over.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that he can vouchsafe for the Thins, though.
But yeah, that's a very good point.
And maybe that's part of the threat, that maybe you trust Mance, but do you trust the whole Wildling coalition?
Yeah, coalition is a very shaky term in this scenario, because these guys are just hobbled together out of everything that's up north. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, Mance, yeah, he got them together to walk south, and he promised them, you know, probably a warm land and a bounty, I'm sure.
Sure.
But once they get it, what's to stop the Thins from just going buck wild in Westeros?
That's right. Booty is the death of duty. And it's not just the pleasingly round booty. It could be the fat stacks of gold, you know? They get south of the wall, and it's like, on the King's Landing, let's sack this shit.
Yeah, and now there's tons of gold in Westeros, with Braavos gold being over there.
Right.
Davos has got the Braavos gold.
Right. Plus Tywin died, his guts spill open, there's gold everywhere. So anyway, John grabs like a butter knife and is going to come at Mance, and Mance like, oh, are you the type of guy that can kill a man after he's made a peace offer? And we don't get the answer to that, because Stannis Demandis comes riding in and basically flattens the Wildling army. It's just, it seems like, again, I don't feel like you bought it as much as me, but when I saw all those mounted knights riding in, knowing that the Wildlings don't have any kind of cavalry, let alone any kind of armor or, you know, training and that kind of thing, I just feel like it was going to be a rout.
Yeah, it could be. I've thought about it a little bit more, and it seems like, yeah, I mean, fighting a guy on a horse one-on-one is tough when you're fighting a guy who's just running through a crowd with a horse.
Yeah, I mean, you don't have, pikemen or any kind of... I mean, the only way you can repel that is with very, you know, highly trained troops with pikes and shields.
Yeah, yeah.
And otherwise, you're just going to get a lawnmower action.
Sure.
Stannis Demandis is awesome. He comes up with Davos on his side out of the smoke and mist. He asks, it's kind of cool, the lone wildling that kind of lost his mind and went at him, and you think that there might be this badass scene of either Davos or Stannis cutting him down, but nope, he just illustrates how helpless a man on foot is against a horse. Just gets hit like a Mack truck.
True.
Stannis says, hey, you need to surrender, and the man said, that's fine, but I'm not going to kneel. That seems to be a problem, and then Jon Snow uses his heritage as a Stark, and the affection that I guess Stannis has towards Ned, mm-hmm, as a way to kind of defuse the situation. Upshot is that Mance is going to be taken prisoner.
Yep.
But what are we going to do with 100,000 wildlings beyond the wall?
Apparently just let him sit there and starve, because he said he can't feed him. He can't really do anything with them. I don't think... Even if Mance surrenders, like we've talked about how shaky this army is, mm-hmm, if Mance surrenders, what's to say that the Thin are going to surrender? What's to say the Giants are going to surrender? I mean, that might be his secret weapon. I mean, how effective is a giant against an army of horses? I think a giant could just walk right through them.
Maybe giants were 10 mounted horsemen, but I don't think...
Oh, I think it's more than that.
11? Guy's dead.
Oh,
10,
no,
maybe,
no,
11.
No.
I feel like this is like a variation of the Reddit, you know, classic AMA question, like, would you rather fight 100 duck-sized horses or horse-sized duck? Would you fight 100 Westerosi on horseback or one giant that's just swinging his dick around? Mm. I take my chances against a giant, honestly, with 100 horses on my side. As long as they're not duck-sized. Duck-sized horses, no.
100, okay. That's just creepy.
Yeah, 100 horse-sized horses, I would take my chances with the giant. So
one thing we kind of glossed over
before
we get too far away from it.
Don't want to gloss over anything.
When John first gets to Mance, doesn't Mance tell him that he's got guys who went around like exactly like we were talking about
during the battle? That's one of the things I want to talk about now, so we can talk about it.
Perfect. He says he's got guys going out in one direction, I think, and climbing the wall and then coming in.
Well, he started a boy band? Oh, Westeros is doomed.
Well, oh, Jesus. Yeah, they're going to sing them off the wall.
Yep. It's going to be like the Pied Pipers. All the teenage girls just come running, screaming. It shatters the wall. Yeah, so my question is, this scene, all in total, till we cut to the next one, is right around 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. Last episode is a little short, about 51 minutes. What if they just took those 10 minutes and put it on the last episode? Isn't that automatically a way stronger episode 9?
I don't think it's a stronger ending for episode 9. Like, Jon Snow walking out of that tunnel, determined to go find and kill Mance Rayder, is a pretty cool ending for last episode.
Okay.
Him going up to Mance Rayder and being told that I've got guys coming around and you're doomed is not as cool of an ending.
It does make it seem...
But because, it makes a lot more sense.
Because it does, yeah, because now we know what Mance was doing. He yes. paraded his guys and they slapped their ass cheeks and painted their face blue just to see
yeah.
the Night's Watch unleash all they had. And he's like, fuck, this ain't 1,000 dudes.
That's like 8 arrows.
So 400, yeah, right? So 400 guys, you know, that was going to be it. So Mance does yeah. seem a little bit smarter, and the whole feint at the gate was to keep the Night's Watch preoccupied with that and not doing things like patrolling around the walls or suspecting a, you know, some kind of sneak attack.
Yeah.
So I feel like that would have made that seem cooler, and maybe you don't end with Stannis triumphant. Maybe you actually end with his troops coming in and doing that thing, you know, the awesome pincher maneuver he rolled out, and then maybe Stannis and Davos from Braavos.
Stavos.
Are walking through the smoke and it kind of fades to black there. I don't know. I just feel like that a lot of the complaints I had in last episode would have been alleviated had they brought this material in, and they might have had time to do some other things in the episode. It's a minor criticism because, you know, I don't think it would have completely saved everything, but I wonder if the flow would have been better if they put all that stuff in.
Maybe, but I mean, that's ultimately, what does it matter? People, when they're watching this, probably aren't going to like watch episode 9 and then wait a week and then see episode 10.
So you're making the argument for, in a binge watch,
longevity, yeah.
Like this, you know, this only affected the 7 million some people who watched and another 7 million people that pirated.
But not like the probably 100 million lifetime they're going to watch this thing, you know?
All right. Fair point. Let's move on south of the wall, way south of the wall, the King's Landing, where Gregor Clegane seems like he is in bad shape. He is not dead. Yeah. He definitely won the trial by combat. He seems like he's dying. Grandmeister Pycelle is content to just poke him with tweezers and say all is lost. Useless.
Completely.
Qyburn says, oh yeah, old man? Well, I got some black arts shit that they didn't teach you in the Citadel. I got moves you don't know about.
This is maybe the worst idea in all of Westeros. You're going to take a man who was nearly unkillable and a killing machine in life.
Okay.
And turn him undead.
Oh, you think that's where they're going, Jim?
I'm pretty sure they're going to make the mountain undead.
Mildly interesting.
How, in what world is that a good idea?
In the world of Westeros, ruled by Cersei, apparently.
Oh, God, it's such a bad idea.
So the one thing I forgot to talk about the last scene is, I think what this trailer does very effectively and what traditional trailers for Game of Thrones have not been able to do, because they've been involved in cleaning up stuff. You know, most of the stuff was cleaned up. This is all about setting up next season. There's a lot of tension between what happens with the Night Watch when they can't hold... Well, now they can hold the wall because they got Stannis backing them up, but what are they going to do about the 100,000 men, you know, and women and children that are camping outside their gates when winter's coming? That is an interesting conundrum. What is Westeros? What are the Seven Kingdoms going to look like, ruled over by Cersei, the Queen Regent?
Ugh.
Is that a role she can survive? Is she smart? You know,
she's done it once, but only barely.
And she had Tyrion pumping the brakes on the worst of her impulses, and then her
and also saving her ass at Blackwater,
and then her Lord Father taking over right where Tyrion left off. So that is definitely another dramatic thing they're setting up for next season.
Mm-hmm.
We already talked about how she's going to save him. It's pretty gross. Involves pumping out some pus and blood, and the process may change him somewhat, but it won't affect his strength. In fact, the way Qyburn says, oh no. Anytime a crazy old scientist says, oh no, you think that maybe, just maybe, it'll make that particular aspect better.
Yeah. Yeah, that sounds dangerous.
Very dangerous. So then we see the Cersei is with Tywin, and Tywin saying, you got to marry Loras, and Cersei says, no, I'm not gonna. And she's tired of hearing smug stories about the time you won. This is not going to go that way, old man. And she doesn't. It's almost like she's read the script. To shut him up, she tells him about the truth between her and Jamie. Mm-hmm. What did you think of that, Jim?
Cersei is not a character who I typically have much sympathy for.
Certainly. That's a common sentiment. You're not alone. Brave stand by Jim Jones.
I may be alone. Who knows? So I was a little torn when I saw this scene of her finally standing up to her father, because mm-hmm. I think it was long overdue, and it's something that she needed to make happen. But I felt weird kind of rooting for Cersei in this scene.
Yeah, I felt the same way, because I think that as awesome as Tywin is and as badass as Charles Dance has been, mm-hmm. I think we're all collectively just a little tired of his shit. And when Cersei says, please, no more smug stories about how you've won, I was like, because I was kind of like starting, my eyes were in mid-roll mm-hmm. when he started up about this story about 9-year-old Cersei. And when she cut it off, I was like a little cheered. I'm like, what the fuck?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What the fuck? What has the show done? I'm on Cersei's side in any confrontation?
I know. It was shocking to me, too.
About her right to fuck her brother? I mean,
yeah.
What the hell?
It's horrific, but I found myself rooting for her.
This show, the things we do for love. We then cut to Jaime and Cersei in the Lord Commander's chambers. Jaime is about to go off on her about her role in Tyrion's impending death when Cersei says, you know what? I choose you, Jaime. I choose you, Pikachu. And then they choose each other all over the room, from the windows to the walls.
Oh, boy. Jaime. Are you ever going to learn? She's such a manipulator. Don't get involved in that again. And I understand why he does. He loves her. And now he's, you know, happy that she apparently loves him back. I just think that's not destined to last long.
So I forgot, in all my excitement of the pre-show stuff we were doing, I forgot to talk about the writing directing. This was written, like most are, by the Double Ds. And it was directed by Alex the Queen Raper Graves. We got to talk about it. I don't want to spend too much time on it. Does this scene, because a lot of people ask me, does this scene recontextualize the previous atrocity that happened, a filmmaking that happened before Joffrey's dead corpse?
Oh, boy. That's a tough question, because the control in that scene was obviously in Jaime's hands. Mm-hmm. The control in this scene is very much in Cersei's hands. I mean, as far as like recontextualizing it, I don't think there's any doubt that Cersei was raped back in episode 4 or whatever it was.
Uh-huh.
Is this supposed to, are you saying that by her coming to Jaime now at this point and saying that she loves him, am I supposed to believe then that she loved him all along and that was not rape?
I don't know. I think that it's,
I mean, that's the question you're asking, right?
No, I mean, that's kind of leading the witness. Here's my take on it. I feel like that they just really fucked up in how they showed that. They meant it to be, consensual, but you know, kind of like in their typical rough style. And maybe she, just the way he was borderline protesting about we might be seen, and she says, I don't care. That was an objection he made, but with his body language and the way he then proceeded to plow her on the on the table, you could see that he was totally into it.
Well, it would be very different if Cersei had jumped on him in Joffrey's death chamber.
Well, or
extraordinarily different.
Or what if he was in the Lord Commander's chamber and he had decided that he's kind of like over her at this point, and like, you know, he has this weird respect, not weird, but he's got this deep respect for the tradition of the Night's Guard or the King's Guard, and he's like, no, we can't do this here. You know, this is inappropriate, this is not right, and Cersei just kept coming.
Sure.
You know, that would be an interesting scenario to have play out. I just feel like that they, just more and more, it just seems like they fucked up and that we just have to pretend like they had consensual sex there. Or maybe the camera cut off and she, I mean, I don't know. It's hard to, for me to recontextualize it that far without just saying they fucked up and we're just have to do a mental do-over.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, isn't it also not possible that Cersei has changed her mind?
Certainly, that is possible.
The several episodes between the two?
Yep. I mean, because that's the thing. I mean, there's while I do think that was unambiguously rape, how rape victims react to being raped is very complicated and all over the map.
Sure, and especially in this fictional universe, this medieval world.
Especially when we're talking about rape in the context of a relationship.
That too, yeah.
And in this kind of extreme form of patriarchy, I can see a lot of complex emotions and things going on there. So maybe, I mean, that's another possible way to recontextualize that.
Sure. There are a lot of different threads that you could pull on there to try to unravel this story, but I'm not totally sure, honestly.
So anyway, let's move on across the narrow sea to Dani, see what she's up to in her throne room / complaints department. She's got this old slave she's talking to, and he's saying, hey, this new world you're making is great for the young, but for the old, there's only fear and squalor. We're getting beat up. We're getting robbed. I'm too old to do something different. I want to go back to my master. I want to be a slave again.
Mm-hmm.
And Dani obviously has trouble. Like, I just fought a war to keep this from happening, blah, blah, blah. It seems like that she has got this compromise that she didn't really spend a lot of thought on. Maybe she should have thought this over a little bit more about, I guess, a one-year contractual slave relationship.
Sure. Can you re-sign the agreement at the end of a year?
And, like, when you sign this agreement, what does that mean? Can he beat the slave? Can he sell the slave to someone else? Is the contract...
Is it revocable?
Yeah, it's like, again, might need a maester or two involved in here with a little bit of ink to parchment before you make this royal decree, but whatever.
How old is Dani supposed to be?
At this point in the books, I believe she's 15.
Okay. And Barristan says nothing about maybe this is not the perfect idea.
Well, there again, this sets up, just the last scene set up what is going to happen with the Jaime and Cersei kind of co-ruling the kingdom as a couple. What's that going to look like? What's it going to look like with them kind of being openly incestual?
Mm-hmm.
They're coming out of the incest closet. Maybe.
Yeah, that's a bad closet to come out of.
Yeah, what kind of repercussions is that going to have? This is all about now Dani's taken over. She wants to rule as a queen, but it's not just worrying about goats. It's not just worrying about betrayals. There's a lot of moral conundrums that she herself has caused.
Sure. Yeah.
And
they've been showing us this for the past several episodes. This is nothing new, right?
Right.
It's just the latest round of it. And it's a big round.
Yes.
Like, there's a lot of stuff that goes down. Actually, this guy, this old man who knows nothing but being a slave,
mm-hmm.
He was only 30 when he walked in that room, but her title went on so long that he aged to be an old man. I mean, can her title get any longer? We cut in halfway through the title, and it was still a minute and a half of title.
Yeah, it's pretty ridiculous. I think they added to of the Rhoyonar as well.
Oh, God. Does she do this because she likes it? Does she do this because it's a custom and it's tradition?
It's job security for Miss Andy. What do you want to do? Cut her out?
Well, she's the only one who even remembers my title at this point, so we got to keep her.
And the fact she has to say that before everyone enters the room, my God. but the real other shoe drops when we have this bereaved father, what did you think when he steps into the room with this bag of something and he's weeping? Where did you think this was going?
I assumed it was his child. I didn't realize that the dragon had had torched it.
Okay, so you didn't
until
know
he opened it up.
Okay, so you okay.
I thought, oh, his child's died for some reason. She's gonna have to deal with another moral
gotcha.
Issue.
But no, it's the dragons, especially the big black one, Drogon. He's on the loose, hanging out the black cliffs. He's very, Little Batman-y here.
Yeah, he's the emo dragon.
Maybe hang out at the gray cliffs or the white cliffs or the yellow cliffs. Do you have to hang out at the black cliffs because you're the black dragon Drogon?
Yeah, come on. That's cliched.
You're going to start calling, rolling around in the Drogon mobile with your Drogon belt and Drogon. It's like, come on. Come on. Add a little color to the situation. So Dani decides, and there's great performances, I thought, from this, his father to be kind of, bereaving his child, to Dani's reaction to her dragging her CGI dragons down to the catacombs, chaining them up. Obviously very ironic because she's the mother of dragons and breaker of chains. She's also the chainer of dragons now.
Yep.
So you weren't very moved the first time you watched this. You found it hard, I guess, to care or to empathize with Dani. Any luck on the second or subsequent watches?
No, not really. I still see these dragons more as pets than children. She walked out of fire with him, but she doesn't care about him. We haven't seen her interact with them much at all. It's like we got one scene of her feeding them whatever.
Yeah.
And calming them down when they were fighting, but that's really it.
It's interesting you say that, because yes, she's clearly a terrible dragon mother.
Okay.
But fiction is full of terrible mothers that nevertheless love their children and regret that they're terrible mothers. And yet,
I just don't think that if Betty Draper were to send Sally to her room and started crying.
I think that's happened. I'm pretty sure she locked her in a fucking room at one point. So,
but she didn't start crying, right? So if she were to start crying when she did that,
I lock a child in a dark room, the weeping will happen at some point, you know?
Yeah, and I'm not saying that she's as bad of a dragon mother as Betty Draper is a real mother.
My God,
not even close.
She'd be nothing but charred bones at this point.
But yeah, it just didn't hit me. It didn't scratch the right itch for me.
Viserion, quit touching yourself. Slap. Roar, fire. Mad Men spoilers. So this is another plot they're setting for next season. What's Dany going to do about the dragons? What's she going to do about her fucking city? How is she going to resolve the battle between her ideals and pragmatism?
Yeah, she's got a lot of things that she's got to learn and figure out and deal with. Next season. Before we move on from this scene, going back to her throne room scene a little bit, I thought it was interesting that what Barristan says once that first guy comes in, the guy who's too old to be anything but a slave, he tells her that the masters are, when you allow people to sign these contracts, the masters are basically going to make everyone slaves all but in name.
That's what was my point. Like, what is the fine print of this contract?
Exactly. This will not stop at this one guy becoming a slave. The masters will find a way to create a society in which you need to sign these contracts. And once you've signed these contracts, you can't get out of them. And there'll be slaves in everything but name. And he's exactly right.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of parallels between this and, like, Reconstruction in the South. If you've got a slave labor force has been enslaved their whole lives and they're undereducated. Sure. It's very easy to build institutions with the rich and powerful that still are rich and powerful to kind of put them back into their boxes effectively.
And they may not even want out, like this guy doesn't.
Right.
They may not know that there's an alternative. And so that seems natural to them.
Right. So moving on to just south of the wall, the Night's Watch is having a big funeral pyre where they're burning Grin and Pip and the rest. Stannis Camp is presiding over it, and Melisandre is looking through the flames and sees only Jon Snow.
Her soon-to-be murderer.
That's mildly interesting.
I hope
there's going to be some snow on fire violence, eh?
I really, really hope so.
All right. Anything else you want to comment before we get to Tormund?
No.
Has a paradoxical, he's chained up, and he's got a paradoxical state, a worldview where the dead can't hear us say words, but they can sense what direction they're buried in.
That's
in relation to the wall.
Like, I have that written down in my notes too.
No, it's like I buy that your culture would be like fuck the dead because they're the dead.
Sure, I enjoy that philosophy.
That's kind of how I agree roll. With that. And I like Louis C.K. It's like, you know, these people to say, I want you to take me to Hawaii and scatter my ashes in the Pacific. You're dead. I'm not doing your chores for you.
Yeah, yeah.
You know. I think Western burial customs are kind of weird and gross, but that's just me.
Sure.
You know, but then to have that viewpoint, but then to place this undue importance on Ygritte's final disposition.
You got to wonder, how does Ygritte feel about it, right?
She like, doesn't maybe feel he anything knew. About it.
How would she have felt about it if you could have asked her that at that moment? What do you want us to do with your body? Maybe Tormund knows better than we do what Ygritte would have wanted.
From what I know of Ygritte, I don't think she'd care. She'd probably say something smart-ass about, you know, just don't fuck my dead corpse or I'll haunt you, Jon Snow. I know you're thinking of it here. Holding that torch.
I'm definitely grasping. I'm trying to find a reason that this makes sense. And is not just a complete contradiction of what he said moments before.
Someone on Facebook said they wondered if this was just to try to make a bridge between Tormund and Jon Snow, that they've got this mutual respect and admiration for Ygritte, and that somehow this will pay off into, you know, how are you going to make you know, Tormund the character is any more than a guy that's raving in the dungeons. Eventually, you have to make connections. You got to make connections between Mance and Stannis and Jon and Tormund and all these people, or you're going to have a big bloody war up there, which could happen. So maybe this is setting the seeds for that.
Yeah, and maybe, you know, burning her body up north is what Jon Snow wanted, and he could tell that.
Yeah.
And so he just gave him permission to do that, I guess.
That's an interesting take, too. I like that. That's good. At any rate, he hoofs her up north and burns her underneath a weirwood tree. Regardless, and speaking of weirwood trees, we go way up north. Jojen's on death's door. But fortunately, they're on the doorstep to the tree on the hill that they've been seeing. That's their destination. It's very Lord of the Ringy, the way it's lit and shot. And, you know, cresting the hill and seeing the... I expect to see Hugo Weaving pop out behind the tree and start spouting a bunch of elvish bullshit. Instead, a bunch of skeletal warriors, a bunch of undead whites popped out of the ground to do battle. What do you make of this? And not just the coolness of it, though we can talk about that. What the hell is going on?
Oh, man. That's the question for the ages in this show. What the hell is going on? So my question is, who is controlling these? Because these are not necessarily walker type stuff, like White Walker beings, right? Like, these skeletons don't have anything to do with the White Walkers,
right?
As far as I can tell,
they're whites. I mean, that's what I assume they are, because they're highly flammable.
We've never seen anything like them before.
But I mean, I feel like we have. There's been some skeletal whites that we've seen on the show before, and there's been skeletal horses
with rotting flesh on them, right? These guys are picked clean. These guys are just bones.
There was a bit of beef jerky.
There was.
I saw some jerk. I saw some mummified skin.
I missed that. Then these looked like you said, the Argonaut type skeletons to me.
There was more skeletal
Army of
than
darkness.
More skeletal than I was expecting. Certainly more.
Well, then if that's the case, they could be controlled by the White Walker force, whatever that thing is.
I was shocked that they retained this part from the books. I thought it's like, as much as they've cut from the storyline, that it was just, and it's like, you know, why? Why have these things popping out of the grounds? It's like they're just going to walk in and we're going to, you know, go on with their lives. Pleasantly surprised. Well, I guess the only reason you would show a skeletal white and, versus, that's W-I-G-H-T, by the way. Every year I try to say this. It's their term for a ghoul or an undead corpse or a zombie. Mm-hmm. The only reason you'd have a skeletal white versus a more corpsey-looking white is to try to show an ancientness, right?
Sure. Yeah, I can get behind that.
So if we're showing an ancientness, why are these guys camped outside of the tree? What does that tell us, do you think, about the nature of the tree and the guy in it versus the nature of the White Walkers and their disposition towards each other?
I mean, the guy in it, you compared him to the Indiana Jones goblet guard.
Yeah, the last knight of the Crusade.
Yeah, I didn't know his name.
I don't either. I mean, Charlemagne.
Charlemagne. Yeah, he was obviously there for that. So he's obviously very old.
Yeah.
He's been around a while, like he says. The skeletons looking pretty old for bodies. It tells you that this is a force that has been around for a very long time, certainly. And I think old forces kind of imply powerful forces as well.
Mm-hmm.
Even if they're not, it seems like this has been contained by the winter for the most part. Like, it's very difficult to reach this place. Almost like whatever force is controlling the White Walkers wants it to be hidden from everyone else.
They can't
destroy it,
right?
But they can guard it heavily.
And try to keep people that are seeking it away.
Sure.
And, I mean, it's a lot of creepy stuff. You know, we talked about in the instant cast how it was cool to see Bran put on the Hodor suit again and kick some ass.
Mm-hmm.
Jojen just gets pasted. That came out of nowhere. Did you have any emotional resonance with that?
When he got stabbed 100 times or when he got fireballed?
Either one.
Kevin, no, absolutely zero.
I felt nothing as well.
Didn't care.
Didn't really connect with Jojen, but, you know, whatever. Good on him for getting Bran to his tree.
Yeah, I think he was a fine character. He was just a vehicle for Bran.
Yeah.
That was all.
Yeah, I care a little bit more about Mira because I feel like she had some more stuff. I mean, she had their like rivalry with Osha. Mm-hmm. There was a little bit of chemistry between her and Bran. But Jojen was just kind of like he was the vehicle to get Bran on this plot, and that vehicle broke down and is no longer needed. So
also with the girl, you could tell that she loved her brother very much.
Sure.
And she was doing everything to protect him, and it. There was a resonance there, but you never got that from Jojen.
I will say it's a good thing the Whites were only attacking Hodor with rubber mallets. Any one of them had knives, and this battle would have been all over. Every other White had a knife or a dagger or a sword, but these guys were just hammering at him with these ridiculously large wooden hammers. So yeah, apparently the only two shoe cobbler Whites attack Hodor.
Speaking of the ridiculously large.
Okay.
I like that they had Bran on a sled here, because how do you expect Hodor to carry around a 30-year-old man?
I guess that's also the guy that plays Hodor has got like a little bit of Andre the Giant syndrome. He's got a bad back, or has he developed one over the years?
Okay.
So he was actually having a hard time with the scenes where he had to carry him, so they invented this kind of sled litter thing to take the strain off.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, what do you think about the child of the forest, this little elfin girl, baking cookies in this tree day and night?
I don't really know what to think of her. I mean, she's one of the clearest examples of pure magic, mm-hmm. I think, in this series so far.
Right.
I mean, she's launching fireballs from her fingers.
Sure.
Which seemed deadly effective. I don't know why she couldn't just stay out there the entire time.
Right.
Destroying skeletons.
She's just fucking with them.
Yeah. So I don't know. I will tolerate her.
Brad's like, really? You let my friend die? My sick, fevered friend?
You could have just fireballed everything around here.
I had to make sure you were worthy, Brandon Stark. You're an asshole, child of the forest. That's what you are. Interesting. So they make it into the tree. Saruman the Dingy welcomes them to Carcosa, saying he's watched them with 1,000 eyes and one. Bran says, are you going to help me walk? And he's like, you'll never walk again, but you will fly.
What does he mean by that?
Well, I mean, there's obviously the warging into birds potential. I mean, that's a literal flying.
But what if he wargs into something that walks?
Well, that's true.
Right?
And he already has.
Yeah, he already has.
He should have just called bullshit. You're a liar, old man.
So
that child's an asshole and you're a liar. I'm out.
Well, I'm just saying that if you're going to assume that he meant warging,
yeah.
that can't be true.
Okay. I mean, obviously my hands are tied about a lot of this discussion. Do you have any fire that you want to bring to this? Or
no, I have no idea what he meant by that.
Okay.
So
definitely something that I will be continuing a conversation in the spoiler section about. Fucking Podrick. I swear to God. We're in the Vale. He's supposed to hobble the horses, and he let the horses go. Can't tie a figure in eight hobble. I mean, who among us can't? Not Podrick. They have to walk 30 miles to the Eyrie, and he has to carry all the saddlebags. Arya's practicing swords, and the Hound's taking his shit. And Brienne and them square off over custody of Arya. What'd you think, Jim? Go.
Super tense while they were kind of arguing over Arya.
Right.
They both got their hands on their swords.
Right.
At one point, somebody says something that spooks the other, and they pull their sword halfway out of the sheath.
Yeah.
This whole time, I was like, oh, no, because I know this can't go well if they actually fight.
I
kind of want both of these characters to stick around. If they get in a fight, I know that one of them is done.
Yeah. Because it seemed like a winner-takes-all kind of fight.
Yeah.
And they're both one of my favorite characters.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I didn't want to see them die, so I'm basically agreeing with you. I don't know what I'm doing here.
okay.
A lot of people were giving the show shit for having, it's like, well, it seemed like they could have just had a few words and settled their differences, or, you know, this wouldn't have had a fight if they'd actually talked instead of just going right to combat. On the other hand, from the Hound's perspective, this looks incredibly bad.
Yeah.
He knows Podrick Payne is a Lannister squire.
Mm-hmm.
He sees that she's got Lannister armor on and Lannister gold, and she's throwing around
Valyrian
name Jaime.
Steel.
And it's like, this just looks like And he knows the Lannisters are liars, and if they sent someone to take Arya, they probably would do something. I mean, it's even suspicious that she's this kind of warrior woman, almost like if Tywin Lannister had handpicked a person to come and kidnap Arya without a fight, he would probably pick Brienne. She's not a Northman. She's a Southron. I don't know that there's any way she could have talked her way out of that fight. And if the shoe was on the other foot and it was the Hound coming in and him being a Lannister dude, maybe Brienne's reasonable enough.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But the Hound is not that guy. He's not the diplomat. He's not the Littlefinger.
Certainly. No, I think you said as much in the instant cast.
He's the guy in the armor with the big fucking sword, and he's not going to go the Syrio route. I thought this fight, and there's been increasingly epic fights. You know, Mountain and Oberon was very awesome in a kind of a showy Ray Parks.
Sure.
Leaping Jedi kind of way. But for just sheer realism and brutality, it's hard to top this fight. I mean, it, like Steppenwolf said, it's like it was watching two characters descend into barbarism. They start off upright and they're exchanging sword blows.
Yeah.
Then they start exchanging fist blows. Then they start exchanging rocks to the head. Then she punches him in the balls. He kicks her in the vagina. She throws him over a cliff.
Yeah.
It's pretty terrible. We see him. Arya escapes in all this because, again, Pod can't do one damn thing right other than apparently please women. She runs off and Brienne's trying to find her. Arya finds the Hound. He's in bad shape. He looks like shit. He's got his femur sticking through his leg.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty bad. He asked for the gift of mercy, and she doesn't give it to him.
Before I talk about that, I want to ask you one question about the fight.
Okay.
They made a big deal last episode, or no, the episode before, about the Hound having his flea bite.
Sure.
And Arya specifically saying she thinks that's slowing him down. He's not walking as fast anymore.
Sure.
When they roll up to the Eyrie. Do you think that they meant for that scene to tell us that the Hound has been diminished by this and that that's why Brienne beat him, or that Brienne's just a badass?
Man, that is a great question, and it's something that's oft-debated in Game of Thrones forums, because every week someone okay. someone has the brilliant idea to be like, who's the best swordsman in the Seven Kingdoms?
Oh, God. It's Jaime, clearly.
It's
been said a thousand times.
You gotta say both hands Jaime.
Both hands Jaime,
because if
certainly.
You don't fucking say that, someone might think that the one-armed left-handed Jaime is the
come
best.
Come on.
I'm just saying, this is...
I know.
Is nerds on the internet. They love this stuff. Like a baby loves its mother's milk. So I will say it does seem like that both Martin and the showrunners have to come up with excuses for why Brienne is winning. You know, Jaime has been rotting in a cell for months and both hands are tied.
Yeah.
And she beats Jaime. The Hound has got a flea bite and he has been, you know, Arya just said last episode that you're looking a little slow. I feel like that they kind of made him up to where he's a little gray under the eyes. He just taken a big shit. That takes a lot out of a man. I feel that Brienne is a genuine badass. She
sure.
kicks Ser Loras' ass, who's more of a tourney knight. But still, I feel like that she could, kind of any given Sunday situation, take Sandor Clegane on his best day. But I think it'd be kind of like Sandor probably wins 7 out of 10 times.
Yeah, that feels about right. I mean, we've seen her take on 3 random dudes
yeah.
in the woods and win. So I certainly believe that she's a badass. I also know that the Hound is a badass.
Sure.
Like, of the badasses in Westeros, he's probably number 2.
Right.
Right next to his brother.
Right.
So to say that, oh, well, I don't know if on his best day, Brienne could beat the Hound... That's not an insult to Brienne.
No.
She's a badass, badass not knight.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think they were telling us the flea bite is affecting him.
And she had better armor. She had better arms. Valyrian steel. Although apparently you can just grab one of those things.
I guess, yeah.
And a very strong person won't be able to pull it out of your grip. I mean, that's going... Like I said on Facebook, my balls retract just thinking about grabbing a blade so hard that your bones are biting into it.
Yeah.
Ah! He robbed Reuter, but no, I feel like that she could... I feel like she could stand toe-to-toe with anyone on their best days. I just don't know that I would necessarily bet on her to win.
Yeah, I think it'd be a close fight.
Yeah, so...
And this was a close fight.
And the other thing is, injured, so. You also got to throw in that she's a little hung up on the fair. She's a little Jon Snowy. She's a little hung up on what a true knight does or doesn't do, yeah. Where I think Sandor doesn't, you know, obviously give a shit.
A true knight doesn't kick you in the vagoo, that's for sure.
That's right. which would you rather take? A fist to the balls or a full-on...
It's impossible.
Soccer style kick to the vagoo.
It's impossible for me to answer that. All I have are the balls, and I know how bad that hurts.
I'm just saying, it's taking a kick right to pubic bone, let alone to your whole
sure
labia clitoral assembly. That can't feel good.
Your undercarriage.
Like, I'm just thinking that, like, if someone took the head of my cock and, like, cradled in their hands and just punched it savagely, I would not be in favor of that, let alone kicking it, like, pinned against a wall or something. No.
That's not the part you really worry about. It's the testes. That's what you got to watch out
for. I'm just saying it wouldn't – the other one wouldn't feel good either.
It wouldn't feel good, no.
No, it would not.
No.
Shall we move on?
Please, yes. Let's talk about Arya.
Yeah.
Arya not showing any mercy.
That's there. I mean, what does that say about the relationship? Is that an interesting topic to talk about?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, we brushed up against this on the instant cast for sure. Where I basically just kind of said she paid him back for his misdeeds against the farmer, against everyone she's seen. She doesn't think this guy is a good guy who's deserving of mercy.
If the Hound had spared the farmer, do you think this goes down differently? Is there anything
I think maybe
have done
it does
to atone for the butcher boy? Because I just feel like that is a bridge too far for Arya.
Mm.
That she was never going to forgive. And yes, you know, maybe he was drunk all the time and he was full of self-pity and this and that. But still, he rode down her best friend who was a child.
Yeah, and when you combine that with his callous view of the farmer, I think that's the 1-2 punch that kind of knocks out any mercy that she would have given him.
No.
Because... she just wanted to kill him, right?
Sure.
When he rode down the butcher's boy. That's fine. I think maybe after having rode with him this entire time and heard his story, and he is kind of protecting her, I think maybe she would have shown him mercy. But the fact that he didn't show any when in the same situation is just too much for her.
Sure, sure. So, the Hound. Didn't actually see him die, Jim.
Oh, come on. They've established that he's 10 miles from the Eyrie, right?
What if there was, in fact, a maester hiding behind that rock?
Oh, my God. if that's the case, he's probably going to come back undead like his brother.
Hmm, interesting.
The undead White Clegane.
The White Clegane brothers. anyway, let's move on.
You weren't seriously asking me that question, right?
It's a mildly interesting question.
Oh, my God.
It's a mildly interesting question, that's all I'm going to say.
I will be offended if they do that.
I mean, this is the same reason, like, people still to this day debate whether Cyril Ferrell actually died, because we didn't see him die.
But he's in King's Landing, and he could run down a passageway.
We didn't
this
see his
guy...
bone sticking out of his eye socket.
Right?
He
and this guy is
a vicious blow to the testes.
He's in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
He's in the countryside. If someone just happens to be there, happens to be able to patch up his leg, I don't buy it. I could not buy that.
It's almost every professional reviewer that I read mentioned the fact that we didn't see him die.
Come on.
I just think it's funny how adamant you are that he is dead.
He's got to be dead.
Let's move on. Jaime rescues Tyrion from the Black Cells with the help of Varys, we find out. He's supposed to go to Lockdoor and give it a secret knocky-knock, which then Varys will help him get out, but makes a pit stop to the Tower of the Hand first. Jim, this basically is the final scene. No, there's one more with Arya. Arguably the most important.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
Which part of it?
First of all, did you have a problem, because I know some people did, with Tyrion's voyage to the Tower of the Hand? I feel like the show did a good enough job showing that Varys has these secret ways to get around everywhere, and there's this tunnel system that, you know, Tyrion had passing familiarity with since he already was the Hand himself, and that he's a smart guy, and he could figure out that, oh, this way goes that way, but this way that he keeps going up and up might go here. Did you have a problem with the fact that he was able to find his way to his father's chambers from the Black Cells?
I guess I didn't realize that he was doing that in any kind of, like, using tunnels or anything like that. I thought he just, you know, knew got his lost. Way. No, not got lost. I knew he was doing it with a purpose. But I didn't realize that he had used some kind of back channel tunnels.
That's clearly not. I mean, unless those are secret tunnels, it would be ridiculous that the black cells would directly connect that way to the bedroom of the Hand of the Kid.
Yeah, you're right about that. I didn't realize that.
I mean,
that
this is like the, like we talk joke about watching 24, like the laundry chute that goes directly to the secure data center.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, where where we house our most dangerous convicted felons that we're either going to kill or send to the wall, can we get a tunnel that will lead right to the bedroom of the second most important person in all of Westeros?
I guess I assumed that his journey was much longer than it was. I assumed it took, like, they just cut 5 minutes, 10 minutes out of this journey.
God bless him for doing that.
So I didn't even realize he was in tunnels.
Okay.
But, I mean, sure. I mean, you said that, I don't know if this is a spoiler, but in the books, he is much more, they make a point that he is very familiar with these tunnels.
Yeah, in the books that, in the books, Shay doesn't just hang out in his bedroom all the time. She's actually out at this other location, this mansion that he's holed her up in, and that he uses these tunnels that a lot of, there's this character, I think it's Aegon the Unworthy, who's this kind of like notorious whoring drunkard king, and they kind of intimate that he and had some of these tunnels installed so he could get to places without being seen, and that Varys has made use of these tunnels to, you know, get from here. You know, that's how he visited Ned Stark in a cell in secret. And that Varys had introduced him a little bit to, you know, that so he could smuggle Shay in and out of his bedroom. Again, how the hell could that possibly be a spoiler? If in seventh season Shay comes back from the dead and murders someone else, then you can say fuck you, Aaron.
Yeah,
but or Aaron. Woo, speaking of spoilers, so yeah, but I just so in my mind it didn't even come up as a concern until I started seeing people say bullshit. But that's kind of like as a book reader, just kind of filled that out. I just want to know as a show watcher, it didn't seem like you had a problem with it.
No, I didn't even notice it honestly.
Yeah, and he's former resident of the Tower of the Hand. You would think that he would know how to get there from the cells. Blah blah blah.
Sure.
In killing Shay, is this a justified killing?
I think.
How did
so.
You feel about it? Because a lot of people were worried. They made some structural changes to the character of Shay to make her broadly more sympathetic from the show to the books. A lot of people were wondering, man, when Tyrion ends up killing her, is this going to seem like a, you know, it's going to put viewers off? Didn't really get a problem with that either.
She was not that sympathetic, in my opinion. she did not understand the danger she was in when Tyrion was trying to send her away. She didn't understand why Tyrion ultimately had to resort to sending her away the way he did. She then turned on him completely in the trial, lied about everything, basically sentenced him to death, and now she's sleeping with his father. That, to me, adds up to being strangled on the edge of your bed.
Does that? Okay. All right. That's an interesting point of view.
In Westeros terms.
All right.
Yeah, I will qualify that.
All right. Do you buy that Shay, because some people call bullshit on the fact that Shay jumped in Tywin's bed, that if she was so in love with Tyrion and hurt, that seems an odd move for her to make. What do you think about that?
I kind of agree with that, and I think that she might have been pressured into it, honestly, by the dancer.
I feel like it's within her character as a survivor. This is the woman who was going to single-handedly protect her and Sansa from the hordes of Stannis Baratheon coming in with a dagger. I feel like, and she's the one that's clawed herself up from her station as a whore. Now she's made it all the way to King's Landing.
Sure.
I feel like once she got over the Tyrion thing and betrayed him and did it with malice aforethought,
sure,
that I totally buy her appealing to Tywin and trying to keep climbing up that ladder of chaos.
Yeah. I mean, Tyrion was no longer a rung in that ladder.
No. And it's his own doing, because you said it's unsympathetic. I kind of disagree. I don't find her sympathetic because I don't like her character and I don't like the actress portraying her.
Yeah.
However, and yes, she was ignorant to the dangers. She was naive to the dangers, but it's not like that was a calculated move. She literally didn't understand it. So it was a slap in the face when Tyrion rejected her.
Yeah, but Tyrion tried to explain it to her and multiple times.
Well, but again, I don't know. I don't think that affects her sympathy. I just think it affects.
Yeah, that part doesn't. But once she
it's a tragic. It's a tragic misunderstanding or tragic misalignment of risk assessments.
Yeah, I guess so.
So he then takes the crossbow off the wall. I believe it's the same crossbow that that Joffrey was always using to do his dirty deeds with, and the loader. And he interrogates Tywin on the crapper with his crossbow. One thing I thought interesting, that at no time, even after the first crossbow bolt was in him, did I think that Tywin saw Tyrion seriously as a threat.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that you, my son, that I've despised my whole life, are going to actually threaten me. This is just, no, I'm going to be able to talk my way out of this, and you're not going to be able to pull that trigger.
So I had a minor problem with this scene.
Okay, bring it.
Tywin, you're right. I don't think believed that Tyrion was actually going to shoot and kill him. Several times, like 4, maybe 5 times, Tywin gets ready to stand up and then is backed down by a twitch or a lunge from Tyrion.
Without even wiping.
Sure. I mean, I'll let that slide.
Gonna waddle back to your chambers.
He's in mortal danger. But my point is, he does to some degree believe it. Otherwise, he would just stand up and start talking at Tyrion like he always does.
Mm, okay.
On some level, he was threatened by that crossbow to the point where he wouldn't even stand up.
Okay. I mean, yeah.
Multiple times. I mean, they did it 4 or 5 times.
No. I see. But I feel like that's kind of, that was him, just kind of placating or appeasing him going on. But I still didn't think he really thought he would shoot him. But yeah, obviously, lunged at him, made a sudden movement, maybe. But if he just kept talking with him and, started appealing to, like, look, this is shameful, let's talk like men, that he would be able to do what Tywin always does, which is, you know.
Well, this whole episode, Tywin lost control of everything.
And
lost
think about
control of his daughter, his son, both sons.
And I think that's going to be interesting when people later go back and kind of, like, marathon this or binge watch it, is that Lannisters were here, you know, cackling over the corpse of Ned Stark's family and melting down his family heirlooms and forging their own swords. And little by little, everything went away till now.
You know, you say little by little, but I think in this episode, like, okay, yeah, they lost Joffrey, and that was a huge blow. Although it may have been better in the long term if these guys had survived. I think that Tywin, when he lost control this episode, it just fell apart like a house of cards.
Well, no, Tywin, like, is...
He went from being in absolute control with an iron fist to being dead in the span of an episode. Like, he pissed off the wrong person. He pissed off Cersei, who chain reacted that to Jaime.
Right.
Who then went and freed Tyrion, and Tyrion killed him. Like, in a day, this happened.
I somewhat disagree, just because of the state the finances were in and the debt to the crown, the debt to Lannisters, that the Tyrells were probably only putting up with their crap because they're ignorant of what a weakened position. That Tywin had some very deft handling to do to stay on top and to keep Westeros.
But he was doing it so well.
On a right path. Take Tywin out of the picture.
Yeah. It's
not
way
hard
worse
to think that Westeros is fucked.
And you're taking Tyrion out of the picture too. The two smartest guys in this kingdom are now gone.
So now he kills him. He goes this as the reigns of Castamere play out for maybe the last time, although I doubt it. Varys says, "What have you done?" He packs him away in a crate, similar to what he did to his old magician friend. Oversees him being loaded into the boat. He starts to walk back to the Red Keep, and he hears the bells tolling, and he's like, "Hoo boy," and gets on the boat with Tyrion, and they go off to parts unknown.
Yeah, I like that the people packing up the boat don't react to those bells at all.
You're assuming where are you assuming they're going?
I honestly don't know.
Okay.
I hadn't even thought about it.
Okay, well then I won't ask the question.
I just know that he needs to get out of there, and that's where he's going.
It seems like everyone that goes anywhere is going to Essos. Okay, which is the continent where Dany's at.
Sure.
And it's the continent where Braavos is at. And it's the continent where Arya's going at. This is the other interesting thing. They're setting these characters Varys, Tyrion, Arya in a potential collision course with these other interesting characters. For the first time, I mean, Dany's had the self-contained story. Do you think that there's a chance that these people's paths will intersect? Or are they going to split this into even more locations and characters?
I suppose it's possible. I don't know how much of a hub Braavos is. Like, it doesn't seem to be super welcoming. I know it's kind of like they make a lot of money being bankers and traders and
well, sure, Essos is a big place, and you got all the slave empire going. You got the seven free cities. They're all, you know, roughly equal in power in different ways. So there's a lot of, you know, we saw Pintos was one of those free cities. That's where we met Dany. And that's apparently, you know, in the very if you remember in the very first episode or the very first season, that Varys and Ilio, who is the person who's kind of the guardian of Dany and her brother, were doing a lot of meeting and talking in the dungeons of the Red Keep that Arya overheard. They were doing a lot of talking about, you know, the time being ripe and all this plotting and planning. Again, this isn't a spoiler. This is just what's happened. I wonder if Varys is going somewhere, if they're going to, you know, get back together, get the band back together, if we're going to see some fruition of these plans.
Yeah, we could. I don't know where Arya fits into all that, but those characters could certainly meet up.
Okay, final scene. We had Arya bounce up to a Braavosi boat captain, flip him an iron corn, say Valor Morghulis, and upgraded the first class cabin to Braavos. Yeah.
Sure.
Did you remember the significance of this scene from season two? The finale of season two. It's been two full years since we've had the payoff to this.
Yeah, I mean, they showed it before. If you were watching live, they show it before the episode.
Oh, right. The last on or previously on.
Yeah. So, of course, I remembered it because they showed it to me.
He mentioned, so I went back and rewatched that scene, and this was in the larger context as people was like, well, you know, what's in Braavos? What's going on? Him giving her that coin and giving her that instructions that, hey, if you meet anyone from Braavos, give them this coin, and you will find me again, was in the larger context of her becoming a faceless man, which we understand is this order of assassins that can change their appearance somehow magically. They're almost supernaturally good at killing. This is an interesting development for Arya to be going on, is it not?
I don't know. How am I supposed to know that?
Well, I mean, just are you interested in seeing Arya perhaps become a faceless man?
Sure. I think she's been headed that way for a long time. And that makes sense for a character to go that way.
Like he said, Jack and Hagar said way back in the end of season two, a girl has many names on her list. And as a faceless man, she could notch those off one by one. A Stark kicking some ass is something I'm very interested in seeing myself.
There is really only one left who can. So I don't think Sansa's going to kick any ass anytime soon.
That's about it. I'm going to reinstate the kill of the week. I forgot to do it last week. There's a lot of good choices. What would you, if we had to go back and give it last week, I think the giant pinging the guy off the wall with his arrow would probably be the kill of the week for me.
Oh, for last week? Yeah.
Never seen a giant fire and arrow into a dude that fell 450 feet and smacked right in the middle of a courtyard before.
Yeah, that was sweet.
This week, just for impact alone, I have to go with Tywin Lannister on the privy.
Yeah. It's either a Tywin or the Hound if he's dead. Yeah, but you're right. Tywin has a huge impact on the Empire.
Did you see this coming? I mean, was this on your radar?
No, it wasn't. I assumed I guess Tyrion was going to get out.
All the shocking moments. So did you think that Tyrion was in mortal danger?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay, good. That's always good to hear. But you didn't see the thing with Tywin. I mean, did you think...
I didn't.
Obviously, I think no one could see that Tywin and Tyrion would go out like that. But did you kind of have a hint that maybe Tywin's storyline was drawing to a close or there was a threat of that?
No. I felt that he needed to be there to keep King's Landing and the Empire under control. But I guess that makes sense then. Let's throw a little chaos in the mix and let's kill this guy who's the only thing keeping it under wraps.
I feel like overall the Game of Thrones community that is Into the Spoilers did a much better job of preserving the surprises for the non-readers this season and last. That they had this kind of orgy of Red Wedding bullshit and the reaction videos and all that, and then everybody woke up the next day like a, you know, the really bad hangover and looking at all the Solo cups everywhere and like, man, what did we do? And sobered up this season. I hope that this rage that they're feeling about a lot of the changes and liberties that the Double D's have taken the source material does not kindle that asshole candle.
You know, it's very easy to ignore all this stuff.
How?
Don't go on the Game of Thrones subreddit.
Man, that's not. No. I mean, you have to avoid Reddit, Tumblr, Facebook, Twitter. It's real. If it gets out there in the popular culture, it's impossible unless you just don't get on the internet.
I guess if your friends are assholes, avoid Facebook and Twitter.
Everyone's got one asshole friend.
Okay.
Everyone.
Probably so, yeah.
So I, I'm just saying that I was very proud of the community, and I hope it keeps going to next season as well. This podcast is proud to be sponsored by Hover.com. Jim, what can we say about Hover that we haven't said already?
Oh, I think we've said it all.
Hey, I mean,
lightning fast support.
No hold support.
No hold support.
You call them, you will talk to a real person. No transfer, no weird menu system. Just, hello, this is Hover. How the hell can we help you?
Included security.
They don't say hell. They don't swear.
They might. I don't know. I've never called them.
If you want, you can ask. That's an optional service. You can ask for the swearing option. And it's tell them you want the bald move treatment.
Oh, no. No, they will. That's not what you want.
But the fact is, no matter what your experience level, if you've got an idea for a website and you want to get a domain name, because that's the first step in getting your idea onto the internet, never searched for one before. They make it easy. They got an easy way to search. They got all these custom domain names. They got easy to use features. If you're a professional and you want to transfer, they make it easy. They got a valet service where it's like all this hassle. You got to unlock your domain and you got to get the code from your registrar, and they try to, it's almost like they try to make it hard to transfer to someone better like Hover, because it's a trap. Hover doesn't believe in that crap, and they got the valet service. They'll hold your hand and help you through all that with a real live person. It's pretty fantastic. For a very low price, you get a domain with everything built in, no extra crap that they try to spring on you at the checkout.
Yeah, that's what I really like.
You get you get email forwarding service, so if you just want to use it to have a snazzy custom email, you can do it that way. We really liked working with Hover. They made it very easy for us to do the stuff that we wanted to do with them. And again, we couldn't be prouder that they chose to sponsor our season. And the best part of it is if you use our special promo code CHILDREN when you check out, you will get a 10% discount on everything in that particular shopping session.
So buy it all. Go there and load up.
Buy all the domain names. Step one, buy all the domain names left on the internet. Step two, ? Step three, enjoy Hover's fantastic interface and support. Step four, profit.
Sure.
I think we've cracked the code. We've got a lot of other stuff to talk about. Go to Hover.com and use that promo code CHILDREN now. We've got a lot of other stuff that's going on. There's a Breaking Bad Fest. I don't know if you heard this. If you go to Facebook.com/Breaking Bad Fest, you can get all the information about it and get to their Kickstarter. It's up to you. If you as fans would like to see a Breaking Bad fan fest going down into Albuquerque, if you'd like to meet guys like Stephen Michael Cazeta, and other cast members, if you'd like to have a VIP party with them at the same location, same swanky location that they had the Breaking Bad rap party, if you'd like to hear a panel, panels hosted by yours truly and Jim Jones over here, if you'd like to see a costume and participate in a costume contest, if you'd like to tour the actual locations where Breaking Bad was filmed and see all the trademark landmarks or landmark trademarks, whatever. If you want to see that happen, it's up to you, the fan, to do it and support the Kickstarter. There's 24 days left. You can actually get tickets and VIP passes and other cool perks. But if the fans don't support it, it won't happen.
Sure.
So we want to throw our support behind it because we think it's a cool idea. And we think it can happen if the fans support it, and encourage you all to check out, again, facebook.com/BreakingBadFest. We also have a bunch of new merch that we introduced, and we have done our typical shitty bald move job of pimping it. We've got a Arya and the Hound t-shirt, very poignant after this week. It's a Breaking Bad and Game of Thrones mashup, Los Pollos Morgulis, something I sketched up on my Microsoft Surface. Which I'm not pimping. I don't even why I mentioned.
Yeah,
that.
I don't know
something
why
something I drew
that.
Digitally.
I record on my MacBook Pro.
Anyway, yeah, we got a new T-shirt design. Jim had a wild hair to come up. If you're dressing up as Dead Joffrey this Halloween,
sure,
or at Con, and we've seen a couple people doing that. They're walking around with the palette makeup and the thing. What they're missing though is the stones on the eyes.
It's tough to glue stones to your eyes.
And if you're walking around, you can't see, and they fall off all the time.
Yeah,
Jim had the awesome idea of let's make sunglasses with that pattern printed on it.
Sure. And let's make them in gold.
And
for the Lannister gold.
He embezzled Bald Move funds to produce these things and make it happen. And I woke up one day and I'm like, well, shit, I guess we got to sell them now. You can get access to all that stuff at baldmove.com/gotmerch, G-O-T merch, like got milk, only with merch. Check that stuff out. Other ways to support us include subbable.com/baldmove. You know, you've heard it a million times by now. You know how it works out. If you've enjoyed our expanded coverage of Game of Thrones and us getting them out a little bit earlier and us being even more comprehensive and doing the instant cast, the only reason we're able to do that, people, is because you guys support us. So go to that, find out how you can support us. You can also do it easily through amazon.baldmove.com. If you're shopping on Amazon and you're not using that link, It's not just that you're not stealing money from Jeff Bezos. You're stealing money from us. And that's what really hurts. That's what really hurts. It hurts deep down. It feels like I got punched. It feels like I got kicked by a steel boot right in my vagina. And you don't want to do that to me, right? Use amazon.baldmove.com for all your Amazon shopping needs. Finally, if you can't bring yourself to do either of those things, 30 seconds of your time, rate and review us on iTunes. We'll call it good. All right, I think we're ready for feedback, Jim.
Sounds good.
Up front, Tackel did not let me down. He's got the name game for the children. Number one, the dragons and the burned child. Amazingly, he used one bullet point to notch off two names. He could easily been one of the dragons to the burned child. In fact, I'm going to give you that. That's 2 points. Solid?
Sure.
All right. Referencing Jon Snow as Ned's child, number three. Shaky right. As his bastard.
You do realize that every person in this series is a child of someone, right?
Oh my god. How many bullet points would that be? What's the population
it's like a billion.
Of Westeros?
There's at least 100,000 at the wall.
I feel like it's about a million lower than it was 4 years ago.
I don't think we have time to run down all the children in this show. I'm sorry.
All right, well, we'll keep it to the high points. Number four, reminder of Brienne's oath to protect Catelyn's children.
Okay.
That's getting shakier, but still solid. Revelation of Cersei's children face-to-face with Tywin. For sure. And those are Tywin's children as well.
All of them, yeah. Yeah. They all rebelled this episode.
Tywin dies. Number 6 point. Tywin dies embarrassingly at the hands of his child. Yep, definitely.
Okay, kind of part of the three children rebelling thing, sure.
Well, but this was the Cersei's children. The reveal of them being bastards.
What? Okay, the reveal to Tywin, I guess.
Yeah. Which,
not the reveal to us.
We didn't talk about that. I feel like I spaced it. Did you buy his... What did you make of him rejecting Cersei's truth that she was trying to tell? Was that a case of willful ignorance?
Yes. And she says that you know it's true, and I think he knows it's true, but he refuses to acknowledge it because of what it would mean for the most important thing to him, which is his legacy.
Hmm. What would it hurt for him to acknowledge that?
It means he has no legacy, right?
Well, what I'm saying is, but it doesn't matter what, I mean.
I mean, I guess those.
Do you think that Tywin's shit is
all? Those
are
his children.
Do you think it's his shit is all tied up in the legitimacy? I mean, he buys into a little bit of this nobility and honor crap.
Oh, as far as who should succeed him?
Well, I'm just saying that, yeah, I mean.
Just this is not right.
Yeah, like his sense of propriety is wounded.
I think it certainly would. I mean, if his kids had had kids together, that's certainly something that Westeros looks down on, and he couldn't have, you know, he couldn't hold his head as high as he does now if that were the case.
Well, I would openly wonder what Tywin would do if he would accept this fact, except for we have a feedback later asking us to speculate on that, so we'll just wait, give credit where credit's due.
Okay.
Point the seventh and final, the Children of the Forest reveal.
Sure.
Your favorite, my favorite, everyone's favorite.
Mm-hmm.
Some elfin goodness to see us in the next season. Tiffany M says, I just read the HBO had submitted their Emmy nominations for writing. They'd submitted only the season finale, Children. I was a little disappointed that maybe Mockingbird wasn't submitted, mainly for that great Oberyn Tyrion scene. However, no love for Michelle McLaren for directing. Looks like Alex Sakharov, Neil Marshall, and consensual by the end, Alex the Queen Raper Graves. What's the deal? I thought Oathkeeper and First of His Name by Michelle definitely stands up to Watchers on the Wall and the Bletch-inducing Breaker of Chains. What do you think? We're big fans of Michelle McLaren, right? Back from her Breaking Bad days.
Sure.
She directed the best episode of The Walking Dead last season, which perhaps daming her with faint praise.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Oathkeeper was okay. She really got to kind of flex a little bit of her muscles in First of His Name when she had the big fight at Craster's Keep. I don't think you can objectively say they're the strongest episodes of the season.
No, I wouldn't say so.
You know, not when you've got Mockingbird and the Viper in the Mountain. So, yeah, maybe she got screwed a little bit. But honestly, you could nominate all of these guys except for maybe Alex Graves because of a total failure of filmmaking. But I, you know, the people directing Game of Thrones are like the elite. So,
yeah, I find it a weird choice to submit. Did she say that they submitted the children for writing?
Yeah.
For writing?
Yeah.
That, okay.
It's a good way to piss the book readers off even more when they find that out. Oh, so the more you deviate from Martin's Holy Grail, the more...
The better it is.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the writing has been particularly sharp. Again, I think, you know, spoiler alert for next podcast, but I think this has been the best season of all as far as the pacing and the build-up and having really epic moments.
Mm-hmm.
But it's hard to single out. I mean, how do you single out one particular episode for the writing?
Yeah, that's really tough. I would certainly not give it to this episode. I would say maybe Mountain and the Viper, maybe the episode before it. Although, I don't know. That's more of a Peter Dinklage performance thing.
And then the thing is that stuff, that's adapted screenplay stuff right out of the books. So I wonder if they consciously chose something that they had more of a hand in.
Yeah, that could be.
As a weird respect for Martin.
Or just saying, well, the Academy's going to know that we kind of just ripped this right out of a book. It's not really our writing.
I'm not super impressed with the Emmy nomination process.
Yeah.
Heather Kissed by Fire said, I just read an article that shows HBO submissions for Emmy nominations has Peter Dinklage up for best supporting actor in a show. Correct me if I'm wrong, but when GOT comes on, his name is first because he is the lead. He's the best actor in HBO's most popular show. Why isn't he up for best actor in a leading role? I did some research, and there's no rhyme or reason. It's basically whoever has Emmy ballots. And I just realized that Alan Sepinwall does not have an Emmy ballot because he writes a series of stuff, said, if I had an Emmy ballot, and he kind of says what he would nominate for each role.
Mm-hmm.
So there's strike one against the Emmys. Long-standing grudge, strike two, is that it's never appropriately gave The Wire any love. And from my research, it just basically depends on what people decide to submit and also what people decide to nominate. So they can do, like, you know, for Oscars and Emmys, I guess they can nominate for certain positions or some strategy on that. But arguably, who is the lead actor in Game of Thrones? It's an ensemble piece.
Yeah.
And if they're going for lead actor, he's going to go into the buzzsaw that is Bryan Cranston.
Mm-hmm.
So there might be some strategy there.
Sure. I definitely think there could. I'm kind of of the opinion. Did they submit anybody for best lead?
I don't
think so.
Male
or female?
I don't know.
Because I don't think there is a lead.
I haven't paid any attention to that. So it's out there and available. It's just I kind of washed my hand of the Emmys a couple years ago.
maybe we should live commentary the Emmys.
You know, that'd would be fun to do that, or the Oscars, especially like last year. I paid a lot of attention. I saw all the big Oscar contenders and made a point of it. It would be fun to get liquored up and do like a live Oscar telecast.
Yeah, just that would be tons
catty
of fun.
As shit. our old buddy Staffa from Out of Continues,
mm-hmm.
one of the original members of the Bald Move Network that then kind of went his own way. Check out his podcast, Google Out of Continues. I don't have the URL. It might be outofcontinues.com.
It is.
There you go. Boom. Boom. Some quality pimping there. He said, I predict Stannis and Davos are both going to die horrible deaths very soon. No one in the world of Game of Thrones rides in and saves the day like a boss without dying shortly after. Do you buy his rule of reverse karma?
Yeah, I like Westeros? The reasoning. I like it. It's solid George R.R. Martin reasoning.
Seems solid. I think you're just mad because of your relationship with Stannis via the Battles of Westeros board game.
Yeah, he's a bastard.
When he throws up the teeth of the stag, there's nothing you can do about it, man. Sir Duncan, on the instant cast for the children, you were discussing numbers and such for the battle at the wall, and I was wondering, does Stannis have his mercenaries yet? We know he got Salador back, but does that mean he has hired more soldiers yet? I'm guessing that the supply of sellsword companies and Braavos is somewhat depleted with all the conflict in Westeros and Essos at the moment, and Stannis doesn't exactly have time to just go out to the disputed lands and hire some company. Do you think it might be more likely that he just left someone behind to go and hire sellswords and took enough ships to carry them back to Westeros while he took his 4,000 men to save the wall? Now, before you say, whoa, 4,000 men against 100,000, no way, I'm going to point that those 100,000 wildlings probably aren't all fighting men. We saw the camp filled with women, children, and elderly and injured. This was less of an invasion and more of a migration. Going off some book knowledge, there's somewhere between 40 and 50,000 actual warriors, and those warriors don't have steel but bone, stone, and a few iron weapons. Then you have to add the fact that wildlings would break pretty easily. We talked about that last part on the podcast. 4,000 against 50,000 bone-armed stone, Bronze Age warriors. Who you take in that fight?
Are the cavalrymen armored up?
But you saw them.
Because I don't remember. That's my question.
They're wearing cellophane wrappers.
Well, it looked like they had dead meat.
It looked like they had like breastplates and greaves and, you know.
All right. If they got something that can stop a bone from piercing them or a rock from causing much damage, sure. The 4,000 are going to swarm the 50 and they're going to win.
Sir Loras heard you talking about bones piercing and he came riding, riding up all the way for King's Landing. Did I miss it? Moving on to Hef, I think Jojen seeing his own hand on fire when Mira asks, how will we know the end, which is 39 minutes, 53 seconds in on episode 5 of on HBO Go, was his vision of his own death. He also answers, you'll know instead of we'll know, which could be a subtle hint of telling Mira his death will be their sign. The fire is reflected in his eyes, much as the child's fireball was seconds before it obliterated his body. Strong point. At the time, I was trying to play it neutral, and I also knew that in the books Jojen didn't die, he's still alive. Yet another one of these instances of the show going its own way.
Wow.
So I was like, nah, you know, I don't know, it could just be, you know, whatever, but it does seem like it was a death dream, a waking death dream.
Sure. Yeah, and I like the idea that he sees the fire both times, right before he envisions it and right before it happens.
Yeah, I think he was dead the second time. Surely, like, getting stabbed in the gut 12 times and your sister cutting your throat, I guess.
Yeah. It still takes a second or two for you to die.
Really?
He got fireballed pretty quick.
God, that's gruesome. good call, though, Hef. Hot Cow Pie said, ooh, that's gross. How did Arya and the Hound leave the Eyrie? Or why did Arya and the Hound leave the Eyrie? So what if Lysa had died? Robin's still related to Arya, and Arya has revealed herself as a Stark. Wouldn't it be protocol to report to the higher-ups when someone shows up at the castle gate? Are we to believe that the guards are completely oblivious to the name of the royal family of the North? Any plausible scenario I can imagine would have resulted in Arya and the Hound either taken in or captured. Even if Littlefinger, Robin, and Sansa were all the way on their tour of the Vale, then whomever was left in charge would have not just sent Ned Stark's daughter away to shit in the rocks. Can I ask, assuming it doesn't prompt spoilers, if this is better explained in the book? Ha, ha, ha. This never happens in the book. So Arya and the Hound never went to the Vale, and they certainly never went to the Bloody Gates, and they certainly never had a laughing fit at it. I've got a theory, but I want to see what you thought first.
Which means the Hound certainly never dies the way he dies. Like, that's how can they change so much of it?
That's
and expect to come back around to it.
Well, that's what a lot of weeping and gnashing is going on at sl/ r/ Game of Thrones and ASOAAF at the moment.
Sure, I have no investment in it, so like
ASOIAF. You have no investment in it.
No, it can turn out however it wants because I don't know any better.
Sure. I think here's my headcanon, all right? The Captain of the Bloody Gates is watching this unfold, and this guy says, "Yeah, I'm the Hound, and this is Arya. Oh, Liza's dead, and this person is supposed to be Arya." This little girl just cracks up laughing. He's thinking this is a big mummer's farce, and this is a bunch of bullshit scam artists, and he chases them away.
I mean, interesting. Okay.
Because what possible reason would there be for her to have that reaction? I mean, we know.
Yeah, yeah.
But looking as some kind of bureaucratic functionary, he's like, "Get the fuck out of here with this."
Sure.
Arya Stark my ass.
I could definitely see that. I also assumed that the Hound just didn't care to go in after that. He's like, "Yeah, Robin's not going to help me."
I think Hot Cow Pie here was more like, "Why would these guys let them go?" There's this dude that's trying to ransom Arya Stark. If they really believed it's Arya Stark, they might not let him get away with that.
Yeah, yeah.
So anyway, that's my headcanon. There's nothing in the books to say I'm wrong, so suck it. Nathan P. said, "Brandon Hound is great. It was a nice reminder that not everyone in Westeros is all-knowing and all-seeing, and that most likely in the future of the series, we're going to have many battles between friends and characters we've grown to care about instead of the normal morally black and white sides of fighting." That's a good point, and I liked what Sepinwall said that was similar in his review, where he said in another work of fiction, Brienne and the Hound would have fought for a little bit and then, you know, kind of fought to a standstill, and they would have had a moment of mutual respect and shook hands and become fast friends, and then Arya would have one more solid protector, and they'd become this kind of weird nuclear family. But this is Game of Thrones, so somebody had to die.
Sure.
And you're right, there's... You know, it's weird. It's not very often when fan favorites clash like this and you actually kind of feel conflicted about who I want to win in this particular fight.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
In fact, I'm trying to think of another instance where that's ever happened. I've always had very strong opinions about who I wanted to win any given confrontation.
Sure. That probably would have happened if Jaime and Oberyn had fought.
Yeah.
I mean, there are a few other people in this series, but...
Yeah, but I mean,
struggling to think of other shows.
Right, right.
Where it does that. I would also argue that there is someone who can see and know everything. It's the old guy in the tree.
He has a thousand eyes and one.
Yeah.
Whatever the hell that means.
I don't know.
Barrett S. said, "I really felt for Daenerys when she chained up her dragons. However, they appear to be more trainable and complacent than Drogon. Their fear and shrieks of being abandoned were proof positive that she could have kept them at her side. Drogon, the loner, should have been chained instead. He's the one who snapped at her in a mountainside, and he's the one that no one can account for his whereabouts." Mm-hmm. Do you think now that her putting the quote-unquote good kids in a timeout is going to come back and bite her in the ass, rip that ass right off, given their dragons, or will it make them even be more loyal to her? Wow.
Man.
She's going to have the dragons with Stockholm Syndrome.
Yeah, it seems like Drogon's kind of the asshole of the bunch.
This is the dragon version of Carrie.
Okay.
You can't go out there. Everyone will laugh.
You're
going to
go
you.
Into a high school and just
You're
rain
just
blood.
You're just going to eat another girl if I let you out.
Yeah, it seems like Drogon's an asshole, and these dragons are, you know, a little bit nicer, a little friendlier. I don't know that they're going to be too pissed about this. Like, yeah, they look pissed, but they always look pissed. They're dragons.
Yeah, that's true. Right? They have dragons are a good case study for resting bitch face.
Sure.
They just 100% all the time have resting bitch face.
Yeah. So she's got to deal with Drogon. He's the crazy one.
But maybe he's the asshole Dany deserves, just not the asshole she needs right now.
Okay.
Sir
I don't know how to contextualize that with dragons.
Sir Barristan Gordon, that's what he said. Anyway, moving on to Pretty Silent One, said Jim said something about Dany not caring about her dragons, although she let them go off about her business without even knowing where they are. You, Aaron, were trying to explain to him that these dragons are her babies. Yes, those dragons are her only connection to motherhood. They are her babies, as she will never have any human babies since she is now barren during to the effect of our favorite witch, Miri Mazdur. If they, the writers / showrunners, were going to add stuff to the show, it would have been more dialogue or imagery that would show us her longing for that aspect of her womanhood. During the second season, while Dany was wandering around the desert and then in Quarth, they should have shown her longing for Drogo and for her stillborn child and showed us how much she infantilized her dragons. I remember how in the books she actually nursed the dragons at first. Dany had milk in her breast from having given birth to a stillborn. I wish they had not taken that out, as it would have made it clear to the viewers that these are indeed her babies, as she bonded with them intensely by nursing them. There is a very strong symbiosis that occurs between a nursing mom and her offspring. Did they think it would make her seem crazy? Like a crazy cat lady, for example.
Yeah, like Liza.
That's true.
Showing any of that would have made this make much more sense.
Hmm.
Like, I view the term Mother of Dragons as, like, one of her many, many titles.
Yeah.
Not as, like, a literal these are her babies sort of thing.
Mm.
And as far as being a mother to these dragons, Daenerys is the Lori Grimes of dragon mothers. Like, she completely...
Drogon, stay right there.
Yeah,
Don't leave the house, Drogon.
In 6 hours. It's crazy. I think they didn't show enough, like the emailer is saying, and I also think she just didn't care. Like, she obviously neglected them.
My God, she's drawn comparisons to Betty Draper and Lori Grimes in one episode. That's harsh.
I'm telling you, man.
That's harsh. Okay. The only way she could be a worse mother is if Hitler and Ava had somehow reproduced.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That would be the perfect storm of shitty motherhood. Let's move on to Rebecca D. said, the season wrap-up dissolved some character pairings and made some new ones. Are you looking forward to any new pairings? I really like the Stannis-John interaction. I also hope we see more Tommen, Margaery, and Cersei tension next season. Yeah, some of this stuff seemed like it happened in another season. The whole Tommen, Margaery, Cersei thing I think is super interesting.
Mm-hmm.
What about any pairings that you're looking forward to? I've got one right away.
A big one that we surprisingly haven't seen much of in this series is Jaime and Cersei.
Yeah.
Right? For as much talk as there has been of their love, we've seen very, very little of it.
Sure.
Because Jaime was gone most of the time. When he got back, Cersei didn't want
him. Captured, yeah.
Like, wow.
So, seeing them as a couple, anything else?
I mean, Littlefinger and Sansa, that's going to be super interesting.
Yeah.
Now that she's, you know, a real character.
Yeah. No, that is going to be interesting and maybe mind-warpingly creepy. I like Stannis Jon. I like Jon Tormund. I'm really super excited for Tyrion Varys. The Tyrion Varys roadshow.
I feel like we've seen a preview of that before.
But it wasn't a roadshow. It wasn't a roadshow proper. No. The pairings really get sublime when they make it a roadshow. This is going to be a roadshow. And it doesn't happen in the books. So I'm like, got my bowl of popcorn ready.
Yeah.
And super excited to see how this all works out.
I'm worried that...
Especially since the other thing is, Varys and Tyrion have never been equals. Like, Tyrion always was in a one-up position of Varys, and Varys was his advisor or something. You know, it's like, I now free from this hierarchy, I can't wait to see what kind of dialogue gets generated.
I'm hoping they're not too free from the hierarchy, because Varys now has Tyrion in a box, and the last guy he had in a box didn't look so good. Granted, the last guy had really screwed him big time.
Yeah.
I just hope Varys is as altruistic as he seems at the moment.
How do you square Varys helping Tyrion with his claims that he does everything for the good of the realm? How is this in the realm's greater good?
I don't know. I don't even know how he would see it in the realm's greater good. Maybe if he knew that Tywin was going to be killed and that he needed to preserve the one smart guy left in the Lannister line, but he doesn't know that
right
at the time. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm super interested. I mean, I've got some, you know, since I've read all the books, I've got a little bit better of an idea on what Tyrion's trying to do and some of his schemes.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of things that I'm doing this season are, what the fuck is this? What is the show telling me that maybe I missed in the books? Because obviously it's like, you know, when they go off when they plow through the guardrails and go off the cliff, there's got to be a reason for it, right?
I would think so, yeah.
And as a book reader, it's kind of like the same time it excites me when we went north of the wall and we saw the kind of weird baby-making ritual that the White Walker. When I see shit like that, and when I see Varys and Tyrion get paired off, I'm like, what the fuck? What does that tell me about the universe that I didn't know before? In this case, I'm just kind of sitting and scratching. I don't know.
Yeah, it's hard to say.
Maybe some things we can talk about next week in the spoiler section, at least me and the listeners, not you, Jim.
Okay.
You're being excluded and made fun of.
Fine by me.
Let's see. She also says, Rebecca D, I have trouble picturing Tywin in the show wanting to sleep with Shay. Has he ever shown any interest in women before? I was kind of hoping for some explanation on why he thought it was a good idea, but maybe it's better just being one of those things.
He has at least twice.
At least twice.
Cersei and Jaime and Tyrion.
What?
Cersei and Jaime are twins, right?
Yeah. Oh.
So he's shown an interest in women at least twice. Yeah.
Okay. I thought that with since Joanne, his wife died, Joanna.
I don't know.
So there's a little, I mean, this is never explicitly spelled out, but there's a lot of hints in the book that maybe Tywin was actually an arch whoremonger.
Huh.
And there's also some fan theories and some hints about the fact that he did some architecting of these tunnels himself to better let him preserve his prim and proper image, yet then get down and dirty between the sheets.
The whore tunnels. I mean, the whore that's tunnels. All that goes in and out of those tunnels is whores.
That's
man.
Right. It's the whore. It's the Lannister whore tunnels. That's why they went broke. It's not
building
finger,
the whore
it's
tunnels.
Like all this huge subterranean excavation to feed
I will have
Tywin's
my whore
libido.
Tunnels.
Just drained all the gold. He doesn't shit gold, he ejaculates it.
Oh,
and
God.
It's just all gone. All
so
gone.
The whore tunnels were an investment.
Okay. There's two choices I can make get even more disgusting
sure.
or move on to the next
sure.
email. I will choose the latter path. David S. says, do you have any thoughts on why Tywin Lannister never remarried after Joanna died in childbirth? With all the marriages, deaths, and remarriages, it's surprising that he wouldn't have his character find another wife or marriage alliance and have more offspring to carry on the Lannister legacy and name. With Jaime being a member of the Kingsguard and Tyrion being responsible for Joanna's death, I think he would want another offspring to inherit Casterly Rock. Do you have any thoughts, Jim?
That's a good point. He could, certainly. I mean, unless he's too old, but I don't know how old he's supposed to be.
Too old to complete the Bone Age. I don't know. I will say that it's always been my thought that the Tywin Lannister in the books truly loved Joanna.
Okay.
And almost like uncharacteristically, the one thing he was just unreasonably and beyond thinking rationally passionate about was his wife. And it was a huge blow. And I think that you combine that with the final child that he had ended up killing her, that maybe that put him off the thing altogether.
I think that's a fair assessment.
So he never wanted to remarry, but he still had the urges of a man. But he had famously turned out his the paramour that his father took after his mother died and disgraced her and made this big point about not tolerating whores. So, you know, he's got this sexually repressed arch whoremaster secret tunnel thing going on. I don't know. It's
sure.
a really complicated character. Definitely going to miss him and Charles Dance's performance.
Yeah, I guess one of the things we didn't talk about with the death of Shay is the hypocrisy that Tyrion must have seen there, right?
Certainly.
From his father, who says, I will not have my son
doing
whatever with whores in his tower. Okay, that's exactly what his father's doing now.
Sure.
So that's even one more knife through the heart.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of reasons Tyrion had to do the things that to go on the murderous rampage he did.
Yeah.
And that was more grist for the mill. Ryan M said, am I the only one who has no fucking clue what happened with Shay this season? Last we heard from her was that she was getting on a boat out of town and Bronn vouched for her. Then she's suddenly in King's Landing screwing over Tyrion in court and then screwing Tywin in his chambers. Can someone explain to me her timeline and motivation throughout? I was one of the few Game of Thrones TV only watchers that used to actually like Shay, but boy, did they go Chernobyl in destroying her character. I'm gun shy on this because I feel like the last time I definitively said who the hell knows, some listener sent me an email that really dressed me down. I felt like an idiot. But I still can't resolve that. Like, it seems either Bronn was wrong about putting her on the boat, or she decided to get off the boat as soon as she put him on, or Tywin. I know that Tywin was looking for her and wanted her for questioning. Maybe Tywin's power is sufficient that he was able to lock down the ports or put this APB for a whore named Shay.
Honestly, that's what I assumed, but
it's gotta
I don't
be
think there's anything that says
along
it's...
those lines. Yeah,
nothing specifically says it.
Anyway, moving on to Michelle K. I liked the finale, particularly the way that they handled Shay's death at the hands of Tyrion. Tyrion's immediate regret upon killing Shay was palpable. and you could argue that he killed her in self-defense as Shay went after him with a knife when she first entered her dad's room. I think that's the key that kind of made it a little bit bearable, or what made it less out of character for Tyrion, that, you know, he was coming at her in bed, but who knows what was going to happen. Was he going to kill her? But then she pulled the cheese knife on him and shit was on.
Sure.
Got out of hand.
Yeah, that spiraled fast.
And yeah, they said, I forget who, it wasn't Maze, Andy Greenwald on Grantland said that the sequence of Tyrion, as soon as he gets out of prison, escalated faster than a Ron Burgundy Anchorman fight. It's just sure. Like, okay.
He's got his trident out.
Yeah, it's, you know, suddenly he's a whore's dead and his father's got a quarrel in his chest and or his guts, who knows. But yeah, it did seem to get out of hand fast. But I think that's one of the things, the little filmmaking tricks, is they kind of made a little bit self-defense so we didn't feel too gross about it. And again, that scene of his just dead face, metaphoric dead face, contrasted with her literal dead face, it was just solid gold.
Yeah.
And such a great shot.
Mm-hmm.
It occurs, I think I skipped something. I thought it was a nice touch, by the way, that Tyrion killed his father with Joffrey's crossbow. It's symbolic of all of Tywin's bad decisions in the name of elevating the Lannister name coming back to haunt him from the dead.
Mm.
Nice take, Michelle.
Yep.
Brad H. said, regarding the Lannisters, I like that all the momentum that they had at the start of the season is completely gone. Now that Tywin's dead, Cersei can rule pretty much without opposition, and as we all know, she's an idiot. Cersei knows that Lannister's gold mines are dry, and I'm interested to see what, if anything, she plans to do about it. It also occurs to me that she no longer has the spy networks of either Littlefinger or Varys to help her out. I know Pycelle had many birds himself, but I doubt he can match the other two, and besides, Cersei clearly wants nothing to do with Pycelle any longer. Jim, does this sound like a recipe for disaster?
I think so. I think Cersei acting in any official capacity is a recipe for disaster.
I mean, imagine Cersei sitting there sloshing a wine cup around,
mm-hmm.
and she doesn't have Varys or Littlefinger. I mean, granted, Littlefinger was working to murder her son throughout the whole season. But still, those two guys are more competent than anybody. I mean, who's going to be the hand now? Mace Tyrell? The governor of some shitty Star Trek The Next Generation planet?
God, I hope not. He'd be terrible.
No way. I mean, she doesn't. There's not a Grandmaster Pycelle. He's still going to be on a smell. Mace Tyrell and Grandmaster Pycelle and Jaime Lannister. That's her advisors.
All terrible.
Jaime is the least biggest, the smallest idiot, I guess, uh-huh. but he's still kind of an idiot.
Yeah, that's not his forte, thinking.
No.
He likes to slice people up.
He likes to sword fight and fuck.
Yep.
Mostly his sister. And, you know, I got nothing else. I got nothing. Right. That went nowhere. Tim from Australia says, I'm not as clear as Jim on where Arya is headed. She said she wanted to go to the wall. The ship captain initially said she's sailing to Braavos. I'm going to have to dry pie a little bit because we actually end up talking about that. Said that he thought it looked like they're heading north, but I'm certain that she's going to Braavos.
Oh, are you, book reader?
I think that's the clear implication.
It seemed like it to me. I don't know. I didn't watch as they pulled out of port and went up the coast, and I don't know the geography well enough anyway.
I just can't consider that's a spoiler that they showed Jack and saying, if you ever want to find me again, give a person for Braavos this coin.
Uh-huh.
Her giving him that coin.
Where are
that...
you headed with this boat? Yeah, Braavos.
Yeah, this it's like, oh, I'll, you know, first class accommodation to the wall. No, that's not going to happen.
You're going to the wall, kid.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, probably not.
You don't fuck with a potential faceless man. Nick B. said, the children in the forest whisking Bran away to safety felt like something out of a Jim Henson movie, not Game of Thrones. I have expected David Bowie to show up and guide Bran and Hodor to Fraggle Rock.
Wow, that's an 80s mashup right there.
No, I feel it.
Or the Fraggle Rocks earlier.
I feel him. The lighting and some of the makeup choices they did with that particular child of the forest was a little Henson-y.
Sure, okay.
Was a little Hobbit era Pete Jackson work. As for Tywin, well, at least we can say he died on the throne. Cue the Elvis jokes.
Jeez.
Andrew T. took time off from making jokes on Facebook to send in a relatively serious email. Sam and Arya are diametric opposites. One is a slovenly, overweight coward that would terrify any father at the prospect of that coming out of his balls. The other is a precocious, brash survivor who makes us all wish she was our little girl. By almost every single poll that I've made up in my mind, readers and watchers all root for Arya and have been annoyed by Sam, and yet we're all wrong. Because Arya is a female psychopath. She's become a cold-blooded killer who shows no mercy to anyone. She's driven by hatred and revenge. If Arya looked like the Hound, she'd almost be a Joffrey-esque villain. It's not too late. Still got like 2 books and 3 seasons to go. Sam, on the other hand, is a whole person. He's flawed. Yeah, he's like a person and a half, am I right? He's flawed, and he smells like the leather on Meatloaf's motorcycle seat. He's also become a killer.
You know that.
But only out of necessity and love. He's driven to do the things he does out of more wholesome motivations. So what does it say about us as a culture that we laud Arya yet barely put up with Sam?
I don't know that I agree with the fact that Arya is just driven by revenge and hatred. I think it's a sense of justice as well. And that's certainly something we as a society value.
I came this close to making the Arya has a very stark view of justice.
Oh, God.
And
you did it anyway.
I did it anyway. Why patting myself on the back for not doing it? I like them apples. Yeah. No, yo, seriously. She's like a weaponized version of Ned Stark's justice.
Yeah, I mean, I get what he's saying. Like, she's out for blood, certainly.
And she does. Now, do you agree that she's a psychopath?
That's harder to categorize.
I kind of am fine with labeling her as that. And yes, she's got her reasons, and I'm not saying that.
Sure.
But she's, you know, I mean, is she Dexter level? I mean, the way she just watched the Hound sit and suffer, a guy who, you know.
That's also a sense of justice. I don't know. I feel like
right.
She's more on the justice train than she is just the blind revenge train. Like, she's dealing out justice to a lot of people, right?
I guess. Why is it just allow the Hound to die a slow death? Just because
he did that to other people. You get what you...
Slow deaths? I never saw the Hound to give anyone a slow, painful death.
Didn't he beat the farmer senseless and leave him there?
He punched him once and took his gold. I guess if you're saying leaving you to starve to death in a war-ravaged winter is coming Westeros, that is the ultimate form of slow death. You got me
How
there.
Do you like this? You got 8 months.
If you're unlucky.
Yeah.
If you're lucky, you'll slip on a banana peel and die tonight.
I don't know. I mean, I do see what Andrew's saying. But at the same time, I feel like there's a little bit more to her than just this blind rage.
But no, I mean, we as Americans, and apparently we've exported this culture very well overseas, we loves our lone wolf antiheroes that fuck shit up and make try to make things right.
Yeah.
So I don't know that that's good or bad. It just is the way we are.
I do completely agree with him about Sam. I don't know what he smells like, but I do think that he is certainly the more rounded out character. He's got.
Stop making fat jokes.
I'm not.
We're
I'm,
above
I swear
this.
I'm not doing.
We're
that.
Above this.
He's certainly the more robust character. So I don't know. I mean, I do like Sam, and I have liked Sam for a long time.
That's the thing. Like
I've never despised Sam.
My problem with Andrew T's thesis is the fact that he's postulating that the fan base does not like Sam. I think since Sam killed a White Walker, people have come around on him, and I don't know that's an even common sentiment that people are bemoaning his lack of courage and whatnot, because in the last episode he was courageous as hell.
Yeah, and I mean he's been stepped all over by everybody in his life.
Certainly.
So I'm sure there are a lot of people who identify with that. I think that makes him a more sympathetic character to begin with.
Right.
The stuff that has happened to Arya hasn't happened directly to her.
Sure.
I mean, it's happened to her family. So she's slightly less sympathetic, maybe.
Okay. Anything else? Or should we move on to the next?
Let's move on.
Brian KW asks, what do you guys think Tywin would have done if Tyrion was crazy enough to go back to his room?
Oh, no way he survives.
Really?
No way.
You don't think Tyrion could have talked his way at crossbow point into some kind of pardon? Could he talk himself into taking the black?
No. I really don't. I don't think that after being accosted on the John and threatened with a crossbow that Tywin would allow that.
Okay, you're probably right. No, I think, I believe guards would be called as soon as the crossbow was put down.
Probably.
Frida from Sweden said, I think he believed her. Wait, what's going on here? About she disagreed about our take on the Hound versus Arya and what the Hound thought about Brienne's intentions. She says, I believe that he believed her and knew that she had good intentions. The Hound even told Arya to go with her once he realized that he was finished. I think he was fighting for himself. He's been telling us about how his family never cared about him, that knighthood means nothing, how he has no home, no money in the world, worth the trouble he's gone through trying to trade Arya to his aunt. He has nothing to live for but taking care of Arya. His protecting her is the only thing that gives his life meaning at this point. He would have fought anyone to keep that. So like I said, he saw what Brienne was all along, but took the fight for himself. On top of that, I think he was sparked by jealousy of Arya's admiration for and sort of kinship with Brienne, which makes Arya's blow so much more brutal, I think. Despite all the awful things he's done, it was heartbreaking to see him end like that. Brilliantly written and well played out. What do you think of that take?
I like that take.
I don't think that take is the exclusive truth. I think it's a blend of what we said. He's distrustful of this Southron girl with Lannister gold, as well as this explains his feelings for, you know, it's basically twin reasons, I guess.
Yeah, and you got to think about the timing of it, too. I mean, after he's beat and defeated and can't walk an inch, then he tells Arya, go with her. Yeah. Who else is going to protect her at that point?
And I felt like that played kind of like sour grapes on his, like some of the other sarcastic comments he's made about her once it's clear that he can't, you know, it's kind of like, fine, go find the she-bitch bit, defeated me.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, he could have yielded when Brienne beat him the first time, and instead he grabbed the blade and, took the fight to the next level. That, I think him fighting up until he grabbed the blade, you can explain away as him being distrustful of Brienne. But if he didn't have this, not only affection for Arya, but this need for family, I don't think he would have fought to the death.
Well, I mean, I also like the idea, like the emailer said, that this is the only thing he's got. Right? I do like that portion of it. That makes sense. That's why he would fight for her in the first place and not believe, pretend or really actually not believe Brienne. That makes a lot of sense to me.
All right, Nicole K, but the K is silent. The first exchange between the Hound and Arya was incredible. I think that the Hound made a huge mistake by trying to goad her into killing him. She has behaved impulsively in the past, but generally she is very calculating, and everything about her body language was screaming, I'm thinking. Had he kept his mouth shut, I bet she would have killed him. He was on her list, after all, and she is nothing if not a woman of her word, but because he so desperately wanted it, he brought up all the bad shit that he's done that put him on the list to begin with, and instead of giving him mercy and crossing another name off her list, she chose to let him let neither of them have what they want. He'll still die unless there's a maester on the other side of the rock, but not quickly, and like we heard from her when they found out Joffrey died, it's not the same as if she had done it herself. What do you have? Do you think that Arya was kind of weighing the scales of justice and he talked himself into a long, painful death? Or do you think that she was just, this was her savoring all of his sweet, salty tears, all of his tears of regret and all of his pain and misery, and she's going to put that into her psychopathic spank bank?
Wow, that's horrifying.
Thank you. I'm proud of it.
A horrifying illusion. I think that it's probably somewhere in the middle. It's probably a combination. Like, she kind of was talked out of it by the Hound. I mean, it's certainly... I don't think getting her angry was the right way to go. Arya seems too smart for that. She seems like she can realize what he's trying to do there.
Right.
And, you know, play against it.
Yeah. I think he could have done a direct appeal for mercy. Like, sure. Look, I know I've made mistakes. I've not been perfect.
Well, he asks. But... He says, do you want me to beg? And he refuses. Like,
that's what I'm saying.
He kind of begs as she leaves, but not really.
He's not equipped to deal with her on that emotional level.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, that is all in his heart. That is all in his chest. And it probably killing him to get out, but he can't articulate it. Yeah. yeah. Totally. Yeah. Listen to our Metalocalypse fan sponsored podcast if you want to hear that particular inside joke.
Yeah.
What else? I think that's all the feedback we got. Do you have any more comments before we say adieu to you?
I don't think so.
Well, if you'd like to send us some feedback, We still got probably, what am I saying? We've still got another podcast coming next week, as I alluded to at the beginning of the cast. We're going to do the season wrap up. We're going to do book differences versus show differences. If you'd like to send some feedback about your general thoughts of the season, how it stacked up with other seasons, or whatever you want, you'd like to, anything that I missed in the spoiler section that we're about to get to after the music that you'd like for me to cover, send all that stuff in to gameofthrones@baldmove.com. You can always participate in our Facebook threads on facebook.com/baldmove. Please, please, no book spoilers. Please be good on that. Not even like allusions to things that are missing, because people are not as dumb as you think they are, it turns out, and they can get spoiled by that. And if you'd like to tweet at Jim, you can do so on Twitter, @baldmove. That's it. We'll see you back next week for the season wrap-up. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
I will see you book people in the spoiler section. They all think I'm lost, but I know where I'm bound. I'm the blood in the north when it all comes down. My word is my bond, and my bond is my word. Valar to Harris, all men must serve. See as a raven flies, and time slips by. Valar my rulers, all men must die. Okay, let's talk. I wish this is one of the few times this season where I feel like even with the expanded time that I've had doing this full time, I haven't had enough time to do the research and preparation necessary to do this justice, just because there was so much stuff people sent me from so many different sources. Hopefully I can make it up for the diehards next week with the season wrap-up cast. But I'm going to get right to the feedback, and then I'm going to dredge up some topics that I might have missed or no one has commented on, and then we're going to get to the final tinfoil theory of the year. I don't think it's such an incredible amount of work to do the book versus show feature for the next show. I doubt I'll have time to do a full, well, to do any kind of tinfoil theory. And also, I just don't want to shoot my wad too much. I'm counting on Winds of Winter to be out before next season. That'll generate a whole bunch more tinfoil theory. But if not, you know, I don't know that I have a full season. I don't know that there'll be enough material to do another full season for next year. Although, you know, I say that, and then the theory that I'm going to talk about today just came up about 3 months ago for the first time. So it's pretty interesting theory. Roose Bolton was another one that came up about 6 months ago. So maybe if they generate 4 or 5 new ones a year with no new content, we can keep that going. But anyway, enough bullshit. Let's get right to the feedback from Connor O. Says, I'm sure you're being inundated with a shit ton of people pissed that there was no Lady Stoneheart. Indeed, I am. Reveal at the end of the finale. I was one of those people until I let the episode sink in and realized that it was the hands-down best finale or episodes they've made in the series so far. The one part that got me, though, was the ending fade to black felt like a solid 5 seconds before the credit rolled. I was certain Lady Stoneheart would make an appearance even for just a second. But no, and sadly, I waited until the end of the credits before giving up, thinking they'd do some kind of Marvel-esque reveal. Anyway, there's an interesting read from Entertainment World, or Entertainment Weekly, with director Alex Graves about the Lady Stoneheart no-show and what implications does this mean for the infamous Clegane Bowl. I thought for certain after the scenes with Qyburn and then looking at the Hound's injuries that they foreshadowed the shit out of that. So let's talk about this. You know, if you've listened to this spoiler section for a while, you'll know that I was a big fan of the final scene that we see in the show being that of Lady Stoneheart, that somehow Pod and Brienne were going to fall afoul of her. And indeed, with the extra long episode, I wasn't paying too much attention to the clock, and I got to echo a lot of what Connor had to say here, that as the episode wore on and then we had the fade to black, I thought, sure, we were going to get something, I think he put it great, a Marvel-esque post-credits or post-fade-to-black scene of somehow these guys being captured, and or maybe it would be something like the books where it's just some unnamed Frey that's captured and the reveal of Lady Stoneheart. And for us book readers, it would be super exciting to see that. But you've got to ask yourself, is that really what you want? Do you want the Lady Stoneheart to reveal to be a gotcha teaser trailer moment for next year? And if you do, that's fine. That's a fine opinion to have. I just think that I don't know that that's how I want the I don't want to leave the majority of viewers thinking, what the fuck? And then there's not a lot of Lady Stoneheart to go around. When would we see her next? Would it be better to more fully develop this idea and, you know, lay this idea that there's unrest in the Riverlands and the Brotherhood Without Banners are really stepping up their kind of questionable outlaw tactics and they're taking a new hard line against Frey survivors and, you know, have this occur more organically than trying to shoehorn it to the end of the season. And I get it. Lena Headey did people no favors with her Instagram post where she did the stones arranged in a heart pattern. There's a lot of non-book readers that asked me if I could, in a non-spoilery way, talk about what was omitted here. And there's really nothing I can do. There's no way I can talk about Lady Stoneheart without giving massive spoilers for next season. If you care to spoil yourself, just Google search for Lady Stoneheart and you will have everything you need to know about it. But there's no like, you know, there's no like being a half virgin or being half pregnant. You're either spoiled or you're not on this one. So to me, I expected it and I wanted it. I feel like maybe if they did the pacing of the last two episodes a little bit better, they could have fit it in and made it be an epic reveal. But again, I have a lot of faith with the Double D's. Again, I feel like that they're doing this season with next season in mind. And we talked about how tough it's going to be to slog through some of this Feast for Crows and Dance with Dragons stuff. And we'll be talking a little bit more about that in the spoiler section. And if they feel like they need that material in the next season to provide some punches, it's not like we didn't get a lot of firepower this season. I've said it's the best season. I was shocked to see people on Facebook say that they felt it was the weakest season of the bunch in terms of the pacing, in terms of the action, in terms of the budget and performances, and the CGI work, the storytelling, the surprise, because the Red Wedding was ruined for so many people. But this Prince Oberyn stuff and Tywin stuff came out of nowhere. I feel like it's the most gratifying season as a book reader. And the fact that we got to see stuff about the White Walkers that even book readers didn't know about previously, I find that all completely fascinating, completely interesting, and I love it. And I guess I could classify myself as an omnivorous A Song of Ice and Fire fan. I like the story, I like the characters, and I found something out about myself this season. I'm kind of Martin agnostic. I don't see him. In fact, I'm kind of, this might be heretical, but I've got a bordering on George Lucas level concern for this canon being in his hands, because the man seems kind of almost delusional about the fact that this series is going to overtake his works and take the story out of his hands. You know, his talks about, well, they could do a miniseries and they could do a movie and they could, and I've got another book that they don't know about. It's bullshit, George. You're bullshitting yourself. And to the extent that you feel like letting this show leapfrog you is a disservice to your fan, you are doing a disservice to us. But I don't know. I mean, I'm using a lot of words to say that I've completely come around to the idea that the show might spoil the books for me. And I think that's okay. Most of the time when I see a movie and then go on to read a book series, I enjoy it a lot more than when I read the book series and then see the adaptation. Because one is an expansion. You go from TV or film to book, it's an expanded world. You go from book to TV and film, it's a smaller, a more constrained world. And I'm kind of okay with getting the broad strokes put into my head through the TV show and seeing the resolution of plot and then taking a nice, it's kind of like reading a Game of Thrones the first time and you miss all the R plus L equals J and you miss all the subtext and all that. And then you read it two and three times and then you start noticing things you didn't notice before. Seeing it on television is a way to let my mind anyway relax and take this stuff in when I read the books and get a deeper appreciation for it. I don't know that I could have made it through Feast of Crows and Dance of Dragons if I had never had the books to kind of, or even Game of Thrones for that matter, if I hadn't had the movies to kind of prime me and, you know, do a lot of heavy lifting on getting me to have affection for these characters. I mean, I've never been able to get through Wheel of Time for a similar, maybe if they made a Wheel of Time movie, I would be able to, but there's just a critical mass of characters and plot where it wasn't fun for me to read. I thought the show was a good gateway to get me hooked on that. And I guess I've learned to stop worrying and love the TV show. There's a lot of people that would disagree with me, and I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm just saying this is my perspective as a big book fan, as a guy who obsesses over the theories, who craves who craves new information, not necessarily spoilers, but new information. That's just my viewpoint. Wanted to get that straight before I moved on for the rest of feedback. Including Mike H. said, I'm wondering if you think that Melisandre has been using Stannis throughout the whole series in order to get herself closer to Jon. It seems to me that she's very in touch with whatever the Red God is about. And if she can even read the flames at the third grade level, she can see that Jon, rather than Stannis, is Azor Ahai. Even Master Aemon questions Stannis because his flaming sword gives off no heat. Asked a question about... hold on a second. Let me pause and answer that. I think we've talked about this in the spoiler section. I feel like the jig is definitely up with Melisandre and Jon, because in her point of view chapter, we see her asking the flames for glimpses of Azor Ahai and of Stannis and of the prince that was promised. And she says that the flames only give her images of snow. Snow is capitalized with the capital S here. To me, that's not even a sly hint that Melisandre knows that Stannis is not the true prince that was promised. He's not Azor Ahai, and that it's Jon Snow somehow. And you can read a lot of stuff in Feast and Dance. I'm not sure which one she's POV characters with and which one Jon, it's kind of jumbled together in my mind. But you can see a lot of her interactions with him as being kind of naked manipulations of him. Your other question or comment says, I asked a question about Bronn's show future early in the season. I think we're both disappointed with how that went, but there's good news as they're casting Lala Stokeworth for the show. Looks like there's more Bronn in our future. That'd be great news. I don't know that there's a lot for him to do. It would be interesting if he continues the Illyn Payne role and goes off with Jaime to ride through the Riverlands and bring everything to heel and bring it under the King's Peace. I liked Jaime and Bronn's chemistry, and I could definitely get down with more of that. And if they bring Lawless along for the ride, that would be lots of fun, lots of lols, if you will. And we'll see how it goes. Pretty Silent One said, Brendan, the three-eyed raven, just being a man sitting in a damn tree. Okay, this will get my book reader blood up. I wanted him to really have been part of the tree, grown into the roots, with roots growing out of his body and through his face. The imagery described in the books was something I was really looking forward to being realized on screen. Why waste CGI on the skeletons a la Pirates of the Caribbean and dumbass balls of fire? Put it to that and answer a damn question about why he's there. I know they will get to that next season, but 40 seconds more and a shared prophetic vision between them would have been nice. Yeah, I could take or leave that, but you're absolutely right on his appearance. I was really pissed and disappointed. Why do I got this imitation Saruman the Dingy sitting, just standing amidst a bunch of tree roots, when I could have a half desiccated, grown into the tree system, roots coming out of his eye socket, raspy voice, really creepy three-eyed crow. And if it's a lack of CGI or budget, or they didn't have the makeup work, then just show the dude wreath in shadow. Like, have the same guy, have him in the same position, but have his face shadowed. Have Bran not have a clear view. You've got all these bones strewn around the caverns. It's a really creepy set. This guy just didn't live up to it. And I don't feel like this is a thing like the Mountain where they can just recast him or come back and have a tree growing out of his eye socket next season, because people will be like, what the fuck? I think we're stuck with this third-rate three-eyed crow. And it's not fatal, but I don't understand, because the majority of that could be done with makeup and prosthetics. And I mean, look at what they did with Sandor leaning up against that cliff with the mud on his face, and how they almost transformed that character. I'm not asking for much. I'm just asking for the guy to be a little bit more corpsey and a couple tree roots growing through him. Totally agree with that, and definitely was disappointed in that. Moving on, Nathan P. said, so Jojen died. I guess they want to shock even the book readers as well. That might crush lots of pace theories. By the way, did you like the Easter eggs I put throughout the cast? I talked about Jojen getting pasted. What was the other one I did? Oh, yes, about Melisandre looking through the flames and seeing only snow. I was kind of proud of myself for sprinkling those through the podcast. with show watchers being none the wiser. Hope you guys got some chuckles out of that. Still, Bran's storyline needed a big boost in interest, and a shocking death will do that to audiences. It surprises me that they pressed through Bran's already small storyline so quickly. What do you think Bran could be doing for the next season or so? It looks like we're going to be going beyond stable book territory, but I'm not sure if skipping Bran for a season and returning to a bearded and fully grown crippled man is good for keeping pace with the other storylines. I guess I don't see it that way. Yes, it appears, to the extent that the book canon reflects the show canon, that Jojen Paste is RIP, it's done for. I don't know, could it be Mira Paste? Could it be end up being Hodor Paste? Could it be Summer Paste? Maybe. I don't think there's a necessary a death of that particular theory, just that particular theory with that particular character. And it was always a long shot anyway. It's kind of icky, the fact that that was how Jojen would meet his fate. Also, Jojen in the books, again, I was interested in Mira because I think she's a more interesting character. There's also another tinfoil theory about R plus L equals J plus and M, implying that Mira is also a Targaryen, secret Targaryen, that we're not going to have time to talk about this season. And also, I just thought that her and Bran had good chemistry. Bran seemed clearly that she had a crush on her, and I thought that might be open up some interesting dramatic storytelling later, when maybe he'd have to choose, you know, between the greater good and saving her life, or, you know, what that this is another stakes that he's having to give up, having normal relationships when he becomes basically a tree person. So, and I think that, imagine the amount of Bran being doled out over the next season, similar to the amount of Theon transformation into Reek from last season. I think that's much more interesting. I think it's also something that, like, you have to really kind of dole out in small bits, because if you hit, like, Jim with 30 minutes of Bran, you know, warging into trees and warging into crow flocks and stuff like that, things could go badly. And for people that are like, oh, Jim, he needs to get off his fantasy high horse, lots of people are sympathetic to his view. I know I listened to Bill Simmons, and it took him the longest time to start watching the Game of Thrones. Bill Simmons' podcast gets millions of listeners. He's a sports commentator, but he also does pop culture. He runs Grantland.com. And he's like, you know, I just don't want another one of them walking through the trees, fantasy dragon crap thing. He watched and he got hooked, because Game of Thrones is not just a walking through the forest dragon fantasy stuff. And to the extent that it morphs into that and goes away from the intrigue and the scandal and the personal relationships, I think it's going to disappoint a lot of people. And I'm kind of in that group. I don't want it to go full on Lord of the Rings. I want it to stay more firmly with, you know, magic playing small decisive roles. But again, that's just my opinion. And that's how I think they'll proceed. I think you'll have a Theon transformation into Reek level of engagement next season, only Bran transforming into a tree, if that makes sense. And also, if the Winds of Winter comes out, or even it's not, they can pull some of that information and keep us busy for a season easily. And I don't think it's going to be boring. And this S, I hope I didn't butcher your name too bad, want to send you a quick word about the death of Jojen. Let's see here. I don't know. I think this is a little bit of dry pie. Sorry about that. So we'll skip that from now. She was saying that maybe this was considered a book spoiler. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, Jojen had one foot in the grave and the other on a banana peel all throughout Bran's chapters anyway. And a lot of, you know, a lot of popular speculation that he was dead and was being fed to Bran anyway. So was it really a spoiler? The death of Jojen being spoiled is not anywhere near pegging my outrage meter. Even adjusting for the fact that I apparently am not afraid to be spoiled by the show about the book. So Josh B said, I thought the episode is good overall, but I can't contain my disappointment over the prison breakout scene. Here's the other big one. It's probably my favorite scene in the books, and they rushed and they botched it, in my opinion. I think Tysha is a huge part of the foundation of Tyrion's character, and they blew over it. I guess they left it out because show watchers wouldn't remember them mentioning it or care that it even happened. I think you're right there, Josh. I just really wanted to see Tyrion and Jaime scene where they talk about Tysha and Cersei, and I wanted to see Tyrion and Tywin talk about it. I love Dinklage, Nicolaj, and Dance's portrayals of these characters, and with the strong writing the show has, I feel like this would have been extremely strong scenes. Even if Tysha is brought up later on, which I doubt she will be, I'll never get wherever whores go. Let's talk about that last thing. Throughout Dance, what goes through Tyrion's head on and on and on is a reflection of Tysha and this love that he lost, and where do whores go, and it becomes his mission, but not quite, because he's not really looking for Tysha, in my opinion. He's really trying to make his way towards Dany, but that's definitely going through his monologues, and that's the key scene. Can you imagine how they would get Peter Dinklage to ruminate over wherever whores go out loud with other characters over and over again as much as they do in the book? Similarly to Jaime wondering, hearing echoes and Moonboy for all I care. How are they going to incorporate that into this internal monologue that's on the page that I think George Martin uses far too often in Feast for Crows and Dance for Dragons, for my taste. Really just beats that into the ground. I'm cautiously glad they didn't go in that direction, because I think it would have been confusing for show watchers. And I think that the Shay motivation, the fact that she loved me, but then she betrayed me, but I turned her away. I almost think that's a more mature way to deal with that than, oh, this thing that happened to you as a teenager that you always thought was this one way, now it's the other way. And I also really love the scene between Jaime and Tyrion. I mean, Jaime tenderly kissing him and their reaffirmation for... I mean, is Jaime and Tyrion's antagonism going to be important later down the line? If so, then the Double D's really fucked up. If them being mortal enemies is not important for the rest of the series, or they reconcile somehow in some convenient manner later on, then they didn't screw up. And in fact, they might have made the whole scene stronger. I get it that, you know, the Tysha stuff was an easy motivation for Tyrion to go on his murderous rampage. But, I mean, talking to Jim, talking to other show watchers, I don't feel like they thought that he needed extra motivation. And having Shay do that little bit of last-ditch self-defense and just how brutal she betrayed him in the trial, I feel like a lot of people are saying, you know, it's like one of those things where it's like, you know, it's not justified, but we understand where you're coming from. We can still sympathize with you as a character, just like we can watch Jaime shove a child out the window, but then get on board with him three seasons later when he's in a hot tub with Brienne pouring his heart out, and we can turn on him again when it looks like he's raping his sister. You know, I just feel like... It's if you're a book purist and you have to have the dialogue and you have to have it go down exactly like the books, you're probably having a worse time than I am, where I'm looking at the big picture and saying, how would they incorporate that where do whores go into the narrative going forward? And can they take that core motivation of Tyrion, the fact that he's really mind-fucked about what it means to be family and what it means to be loved unconditionally, can they paint that onto his relationship with Jaime and Shay? And I think the easy answer to that is yes, they can. And yes, Peter Dinklage can sell it. And we're not going to have any problems with that next season. But I could be wrong. And I totally respect your opinion and your disappointment for not seeing that go down the way that it did in the books. Jesse K said, my first problem with the episode was the omission of Lady Stoneheart. I thought it would have been a good cliffhanger if Brienne and Pod had been captured by the Brotherhood. Also didn't like Jojen, so a lot of dry pie there. Also want to ask if you think they will trade Rattleshirt for Tormund. It seems this is more and more likely. Can't wait for next year. I don't know, man, because here's the thing. I always look at what is the barest dramatic bones that the Double D's can hang or plot on and not be a complete betrayal of George R. Martin's work and have the most economy of characters. They already introduced Rattlebones as a significant dude. He's got a very distinctive look that you throw him up in the previously on Game of Thrones and people are going to be like, oh yeah, that motherfucker. We also know that eventually, unless they're going to completely deviate from the books, Mance Rayder's got to go south of Winterfell and do his Able the Bard routine. And Tormund and Jon are left to kind of forge this uneasy alliance between the Night's Watch and the Wildlings and do all that stuff. And we also think that Melisandre is going to sacrifice somebody with royal blood to make a big show of submission to the Wildlings and Stannis' people. There's three roles, and if you leave out Rattleshirt, there's one vacant. So I think we're going to see a previously on, and we're going to see Rattleshirt's stupid giant skull helmet, and then we're going to see him burn in that episode. And there's going to be prominent displays of red rubies, and we're going to start making those connections between Melisandre and Stannis' sword and rattle shirts and all the glamoring and stuff that goes on. So I could be wrong again, but that's how I see it. And I do think that else rattle shirt was a completely unnecessary addition to make. They didn't need to introduce him. They could have had it been Tormund all along and saved the economy of characters. And they do. I mean, for as much as we rag on them for having such a huge cast, they also do a very good job of paring it down before they add new people. I mean, yeah, it sucks that Pip died. It sucks that Grin died. It sucks that Jojen died. It sucks that Tywin died, really, when you come down to it from a character standpoint. But those are four, you know, two minor, one mid-level, and one major slot that can be filled with other faces next season. And, you know, with all these characters going off to places in Essos and to Braavos and to Slaver's Bay and all the people we know that need to be introduced next season, those slots are going to be super valuable. So I think I took care of all the book reader outrage. There wasn't any book reader outrage about the Hound and Brienne scene because I think it was well done and it stayed true to the spirit of the books and mainly centered around Lady Stoneheart and Tysha. And the Three-Eyed Crow being a total fucking jip, which I guess I got a wait-and-see attitude about Lady Stoneheart. I totally agree on the Three-Eyed Raven, but I don't think it's fatal. I just don't know why. It's kind of like, you know, in season two, they really half-assed the half-hand, the Khorne half-hand part, and it seemed like they didn't have to. And there was a lot more epic stuff in the book, and then it was just as expensive or lack thereof the film, and it would have been better and greater. Just like I didn't understand why they weirdly scaled down the CGI part of the battle they showed last. You know, why did they make it seem like Mance was a complete idiot, sending a bunch of, you know, unprotected troops up to the wall and the climbing, you know, when the book stuff, the last stand in that tunnel with the murder holes and everything was already awesome. I kind of don't understand why they do it sometimes, but, you know, I'm not the one writing these things. I'm not the one storyboarding them. I'm not the one shooting them. And it's hard to argue overall with the results that we're getting. Okay, are you ready? Are you buckled in for the last segment for this season of the Tinfoil Theory? This is one that got released on Reddit beginning of the season, about 3 months ago, by a user that goes by the name of Roadside Rose. And it's solid, you know, when I first talked about doing this tinfoil theory, I thought mostly I would do 5 to 10 minute puff pieces like Varys is a Merling or Varys is Ilio's wife or Varys is a woman. There's a lot of Varys theories and, you know, Benjen Stark is Daario Naharis and some of the fun ones that don't have a lot of textual support and are more silly and you kind of laugh at them. But when I did the ones I did and I got in-depth quotes and a texture, I just feel like I kind of spoiled myself and maybe everybody listening with that these weren't just going to be puff pieces and stupid, that there was going to be some hardcore evidence to make people think. And I kind of went away from the tinfoil and I went more towards the Valyrian steel side of the fan theories and speculation. I feel like this is very close to the Roose Bolton as a vampire. It's tinfoil, but there's a lot of textual evidence and a lot of interesting story possibilities and a lot of thematic stuff going on with it. It's the theory that the new High Septon, the Sparrow-led or Sparrow-born High Septon, is in fact Howland Reed. Are you ready for this? Let's talk about this again. This is not my theory. This is Roadside Rose on Reddit. You can search for this. If you search for High Septon tinfoil theory, you should be the first link you see on Reddit or on Google. We don't know a lot about the current High Septon. There's a quote in the books where it says Qyburn's whisperers claimed that the Septon Lucian had nine votes from elevation when the doors in the Great Sept had given way and the sparrows came pouring in with their leader on their shoulder and axes on their hands. So it looked like that there was going to be an establishment candidate for Pope/High Septon. And at the last minute, this popular support of these sparrows, these, you know, hedge knights and poor downtrodden people with staves and scythes and threshers had burst in and taken over the whole thing and appointed this unknown person as the High Septon, much to Cersei and everyone else's chagrin. We also know that he is withholding the traditional anointing of the king, something that stretched back in tradition since the Westeros has been united as the Seven Kingdoms underneath the Iron Throne, that the High Septon would bless the new king. And this isn't, you know, this is just a ritual, right? But there's a lot of legitimacy with the common people. And we've talked about this before, that the common people and a rebellion would be disastrous, especially as fragile as the Lannister position is in Dance of Dragons and Feast for Crows. But he's not blessing Tommen because he's got some things he wants to extort from Cersei, maybe. He says himself that the hour is not ripe. In Cersei's POV chapter in Feast for Crows, one of the things that this tinfoil theory speculates is maybe he's waiting for a different king. Maybe he's withholding a blessing intentionally. Why would he do that? Well, let's look at this. Who this High Septon is. Cersei describes him. She comes into the chapter and asks where he's at, and one of the Septons said that he's cleaning the floor of the Sept of Baelor. We find out that the speaker is shorter than the queen by several inches and as thin as a broom handle. He says, work is a form of the prayer most pleasing to the smith. He stood, scrub brush in hand. Your grace, we've been expecting you. The man's beard was gray and brown and closely trimmed, his hair tied up in a hard knot behind his head. Those robes were clean, they were frayed and patched as well. He had rolled his sleeves up to his elbows as he scrubbed, but below the knees the cloth was soaked and sodden. His face was sharply pointed, with deep-set eyes as brown as mud. His feet are bare, she saw with dismay. They were hideous as well, hard and horny things, thick with callus. You are his high holiness, Cersei says. Again, this is in Feast for Crows. This is a description of the High Septon. If you recall, when Brienne was heading to Duskendale, she meets a Septon who has a similar description. I think this is Septon Maribold. The man asked Brienne and his companions to join the Sparrows headed to King's Landing. It says the Septon had a lean, sharp face and a short beard, grizzled gray and brown. His thin hair was pulled back and knotted behind his head, and his feet were as bare and black, gnarled and hard as tree roots. The physical description of this High Septon matches the physical description of the Septon that Brienne met on the road. Now, why is this significant? Well, I think it establishes that they're the same person. I do believe that, regardless of the rest of the tinfoil's validity, I do believe that Septon Maribold is the new High Septon. It also points that this person was coming from the north and heading south to King's Landing, but he runs around barefoot, so it's unlikely that he's on the far north. So this would put him into the Riverlands, or more specifically, it would put him indigenous to the Neck region. Well, the Neck is where the Crannogan live. And also, the general description of this person, the smallness, the sharp features, the skinniness, the way he kind of styles and grooms himself broadly matches the other Crannogan men that we've met in the story. Let me read you a description of Bran's first meeting with Mira and Jojen in a Clash of Kings. It says, as the newcomers walked the length of the hall, Bran saw that one was indeed a girl, Mira, though he would never have known it by her dress. She wore lambskin breeches, soft to thong use, a sleeveless jerkin armored in bronze scales. Though near Rob's age, she was slim as a boy, with long brown hair knotted behind her head. The brother was several years younger and bore no weapons. His garb was green, even the leather of his boots. When he came closer, Bran saw his eyes were the color of moss. Both reeds were slight of build, slender as swords, and scarcely taller than Bran himself. So again, we see they're slim, they're short, they have their hair knotted behind their head in a distinctive style, similar to the High Septon, similar to this other Septon. So we've got a rough physical description between the Septons matching that of a Crannogan man. What else for evidence? Well, let's look at the interaction he has with Cersei here, the High Septon. He says, have you seen what they've done? This is Cersei with blessed Baelor's statue. They befoul the plaza with their pigs and their goats and their night's soil. Here she's complaining about the Sparrows, these poor indigent people that have, you know, armed up for the faith, and they're just living in squalor in the Sept of Baelor because they've turned it into kind of this, camp for these people. The High Septon responds, night soil can be washed away more easily than blood, your grace. If the plaza was befouled, it was befouled by the execution that was done here. Cersei thinks to herself, he dares throw Ned Stark in my face? She says, we all regret that. Joffrey was young, and it was not as wise as he may have been. Lord Stark should have been beheaded elsewhere out of respect for blessed Baelor, but the man was a traitor, let us not forget. The High Septon responds, King Baelor forgave those who conspired against him. Roadside Rose says that this shows an affection that the High Septon had for Ned Stark, that he's willing to throw his innocence into Cersei's faith. Kind of circumstantial evidence. But we got to ask ourselves, why would Howland Reed, who is a staunch advocate of the old gods, who, you know, worships the trees and has affinity for nature, all this, why would he be parading around as a Septon of the Seven? We know what Bran has to say about the Crannogan in A Clash of Kings. It says he tried to recall that he'd been taught of the Crannogan, who dwelt among the bogs of the Neck and seldom left their wetlands. They were poor folk, fishers and frog hunters, who lived in houses of thatch and woven reeds on floating islands hidden in the deeps of the swamp. It was said that they were a cowardly people who fought with poison weapons and preferred to hide from foes rather than face them in open battle. And yet Howland Reed had been one of his father's staunchest companions during the war for King Robert's crown before Bran was born. So, here we see that the Crannogan men, some people call them cowards, but another way you could say is that they're, you know, guerrilla fighters. They believe in guerrilla warfare. They're like the special ops of Westeros. They pop into shadows. They hit you with the poison darts. They've got movable castles. They're master of hiding their ways. You can't track them. What would a Crannogan man do if you go back and think about all the things I told you about the Grand Northern Conspiracy over the last 3 weeks? What would a Crannogan man do if he had a letter, if he knew that Jon Snow was actually a secret Targaryen and a secret Stark and a possible heir to the throne, and he got a letter from Robb Stark that was delivered to him by Lady Stoneheart that legitimized Jon as a Stark? What would he do if he wanted to best put himself in a position to assist the Stark cause and to assist not only him returning to the King of the North, but perhaps being crowned as ruler of all Westeros? He might put on the disguise of a Septon. He might, you know, I can easily see Howland Reed running around the Neck barefoot, climbing trees, doing all those things. Putting on this disguise of a Septon and going, winning popular support, raising this peasant army that is at the time of Dance with Dragons and Feast for Crows, already outclassing what is left of the Lannister forces at the capital, and putting himself in a position where he can, at the right time, legitimize and proclaim Jon Stark, Jon Snow / Stark, as the true heir to the throne and the ruler of Westeros. So it's arguable that if this is Howland Reed as the High Septon, that he's able to finagle himself into position as the most powerful man in King's Landing right now. He's in an ideal position to help Jon Snow if he wanted to make a bid for legitimacy. Anyway, I thought it was interesting. If you go to the thread on Reddit, you'll see in the comments, in the highest rated comments, that there is some parallels between this and Howland Reed possibly being the identity of the Knight of the Laughing Tree at the Tournament of Harrenhal that we talked about in the R plus L equals J theory discussion. Again, this is pretty tinfoily. But it could be someone putting two and two together and maybe a step ahead of George Martin. There's not a lot of foreshadowing in the text there, but we do know from Martin, from his Q&As and from his public appearances, that Howland Reed is going to make an appearance. And he kind of gave a circumspect answer right when Dance of Dragon is released. Someone asked him if they will ever see Howland Reed, and he gave this really neutral response that would leave it to be open to whether he's already made an appearance or he will make an appearance. And if it was in fact the High Septon, well, then he's already made his appearance. So again, it's tinfoily, but I feel like it's kind of Roose Bolton type tinfoily. Could very well be true. Could be full of crap, but it's fun to think about. Love to hear your feedback on what you think, or if you find any other textual support, anything that you find in the other threads, because there's, since then, this is a newly developed thread. There's a lot of posts on it. If you see anything that I've missed, let me know about that. Hope you've enjoyed this installment. It's been a marathon of a podcast, but it's been fun to research, and I hope you've enjoyed listening to it, and I will see you next week.